Jumbasail. I read it, but I loved Goliath. Goliath was my favourite.
This Cultural Life with me, John Wilson, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starts this morning at 11.
And this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 29th of August. This is Today with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson.
The headlines this morning. The organisation representing British retailers says it's vital to tackle a new trend of dishonest traders buying shoplifted goods to sell on. We hear how shoplifting pays from a man who stole for years.
I'd know which shop to go to sell it on. Well, they didn't want to get seen on the camera. They'd take me into the back room. I'd lay it out on the floor. We'd discuss a price. I was the cheapest wholesaler.
We'll talk to Norfolk Police, which has the highest charging rate for shoplifting of all forces in England and Wales. And the head of the United Nations has called for an immediate end to Israel's major military operation in the occupied West Bank.
Also in today's programme, Germany's ambassador to the UK joins us on the morning after the Prime Minister's talks about resetting relations between the UK and Europe post-Brexit. No smoking outdoors when you're at a pub or a football stadium. That is what the government is now considering. Is it a good idea? And New England cricket captain Ollie Pope talks to Gary about the friend who's always there for them, always there for him, whether he scored a century or a golden duck.
I think it's important in cricket just to try and switch off, and I think that's why having a dog's really good. He doesn't care how many runs I get or if we win or lose, so that's always a positive.
That interview in full at 8.25. It's all after the BBC News read this morning by Alan Smith.
Retailers have warned of what they call a worrying new trend of unscrupulous shopkeepers and market traders buying stolen items from shoplifters and selling them on to consumers. A BBC News investigation has also managed to uncover examples of this type of trade. Organisations representing retailers say tougher action to tackle the trend is vital. Jim Connolly has this report.
Shoplifting is at the highest level since records began 20 years ago. More than 430,000 offences were recorded last year across England and Wales. But the industry body, the British Retail Consortium, estimates that that figure only reflects around a third of retail crimes. It's also told the BBC it wanted more police action to tackle a new trend where unscrupulous shops and traders buy stolen goods from shoplifters to sell on. We've seen evidence of this from a shop owner and heard directly from a shoplifter who until recently used to do it himself. The National Police Chiefs Council says its focus is on ensuring those involved are brought to justice.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on Israel to halt its military operation in the north of the occupied West Bank immediately. Palestinian health officials say at least 10 people have been killed during what Israel describes as counter-terror raids. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell.
With the war in Gaza still raging, Israel's biggest operation in the West Bank in some 20 years is causing international alarm. These dangerous developments are fueling an already explosive situation, the head of the UN said. The EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, warned against a war extension from Gaza. Palestinians say there have been casualties and damage to homes and infrastructure in Jenin, Tulkarm, Nablus and Tubas. The Israeli military describes it as a counter-terrorism operation and says it's made arrests and found weapons and sites used by Palestinian armed groups, including a command centre and an explosives lab in a mosque.
Ministers are considering restrictions on smoking outdoors as part of a drive to phase out tobacco. As first reported by The Sun, smoking could be banned in pub gardens and outside hospitals and sports grounds. More from our political correspondent David Cornock.
Rishi Sunak's Conservative government tried to outlaw the sale of cigarettes to anyone born after January 2009, but its bill failed when the election was called. Keir Starmer's administration promised something similar in the King's Speech, and it now appears its tobacco and vapes bill will go much further, extending the existing ban on smoking in indoor public places to areas such as pub gardens, outdoor restaurants and sports grounds. The Department of Health and Social Care said it didn't comment on leaks, but it said it was considering a range of measures to finally make Britain smoke-free.
The founder and chief executive of Telegram, Pavel Durov, has been placed under formal investigation in France as part of a probe into allegations of organised crime on the messaging app. The Russian-born billionaire, who was arrested outside Paris on Saturday, has been granted bail in the condition he reports to police twice a week and remains in France. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Pavel Durov is sometimes described as the Mark Zuckerberg of Russia. He was born there, but he left the country in 2014 and is now a citizen of both France and Dubai. The Telegram messaging platform he founded is currently used by nearly 1 billion people worldwide. What's different about it is that huge groups of up to 200,000 people can share information and content on it. His lawyer said it was absurd to suggest that he could be implicated in any crime committed on the app.
Medals are up for grabs in track cycling, swimming and taekwondo at the Paralympics in Paris today. The games were officially opened last night at a spectacular ceremony in the Place de la Concorde. Like the Olympics last month, it was the first time the Paralympic opening ceremony had taken place away from the main stadium. And a network of wildlife charities is calling for beavers to be released into rivers across England and Wales. The Wildlife Trust say the beaver is a keystone species that can bring huge benefits to nature, but governments have failed to put in place steps to return them to the wild. More from our environment correspondent Helen Briggs.
Beavers went extinct in Britain 400 years ago, but in the last few years they've been reintroduced in fenced enclosures on nature reserves or have been discovered living in rivers through unlicensed releases and escapes. Now the Wildlife Trusts are calling for a change in policy in England and Wales to allow official reintroductions not just in fenced areas but also into the wild, as happens in Scotland. They say scientific studies show beavers can improve water quality, help alleviate flooding and give a huge boost to habitats and wildlife. But there's opposition from some farmers and landowners who say the animals can damage crops.
That was our environment correspondent, Helen Briggs.
Helen, thank you very much indeed. 6 minutes past six. Will the sun continue to shine, at least in the southeast, where it was hot and sunny yesterday? Matt Taylor can tell us. Morning, Matt.
Morning, Nick. It will do across southern and eastern areas. A bit fresher, though, today. We got 30.1 Celsius at Cambridge yesterday afternoon. Way down on that this afternoon by about 6 degrees. But out there this morning, it's around 3, 4 Celsius cooler than it was 24 hours ago. But lovely start across much of southern England, the Channel Islands, Midlands, East Anglia and northeast England. Plenty of sunshine to get the day underway. Bit of fair weather cloud building up as we go through the day. Still some good sunny spells. Northeast England, outside chance of a passing light shower, but the vast majority will be dry. As I said, temperatures down on yesterday, but still pleasant in the sunshine, 20 to 24 degrees. For Wales, northwest England and the Isle of Man, a bit more cloud around here this morning, some outbreaks of mainly light and patchy rain, especially northwest England and north Wales. A few showers possible through the day as that cloud continues to break up. More in the way of sunshine though through the second half of the afternoon and into the evening. 16 to 19 degrees, the highs here. Northern Ireland, a mixture of sunny spells and one or two showers dotted around through the day. The showers could be a little bit on the heavy side this morning, but a lot of dry weather through the afternoon. Highs of 15 to 18. Similar sort of temperatures in Scotland as well. Best the sunshine to start with in the northeast. Lots of cloud elsewhere, damp across some western coasts and hills. The cloud, though, will break up. More sunshine into the afternoon. Still a few passing showers and breezy in the far north. Highs of 15 to 18.
Thanks very much, Matt. Let's take a first look at the papers. Brexit reset is the headline in the Daily Mirror, which leads with Sir Keir Starmer's attempt to foster a closer relationship with Europe. The paper points out that new plans on trade, illegal migration, security and technology feature in a treaty being hammered out with Germany. But EU sources tell The Eye that if Sir Keir wants to improve relations, he'll have to agree to a key demand from Brussels, the easing of immigration rules for young Europeans. Government insiders tell the Financial Times that ministers want to bolster education and cultural exchanges. However, they insist that would not be comparable to the youth mobility schemes suggested by some within the bloc.
The Sun leads with an exclusive about leaked government plans, which it says feature drastically toughened up proposals to phase out smoking. The paper says the immensely radical and controversial clampdown has sparked tensions in the cabinet, with memos reportedly showing that the Department for Business has fears about the financial cost to the hospitality sector. The paper claims the plan would be a death knell for pubs, accusing the government of being a nanny state on steroids.
The Daily Mail is warning drivers to brace for a multi-billion pound fuel duty raid under what it calls Starmer's squeeze. It says the government has refused to rule out using motorists to balance the books in the autumn budget and accuses ministers of rowing back on their pledge not to hike taxes for working people. According to the Daily Telegraph, increasing fuel duty by 5p a litre would raise more than £2 million, going some way to filling the £22 billion pound fiscal black hole identified by the Chancellor.
The Chief Inspector of Probation tells the Times that it is inevitable that things will go wrong when thousands of prisoners are released early next month in an effort to tackle overcrowding in jails. In the interview, Martin Jones warns that the government is rolling the dice, saying that the move will put extra strain on a probation service which lacks the resources to cope. But he acknowledges that there are no risk-free options available.
A new report by the leading think tank, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, is highlighted on the front page of The Guardian. The IFS says that woeful budgeting by the Home Office under the Conservative government led to repeated overspending on asylum support. The paper says that the findings partially vindicate Rachel Reeves's claim that the Labour administration inherited a far worse financial situation than initially thought.
Tensions are growing in Downing Street, according to The Times, which says some advisers are uneasy about the proposed appointment to the Prime Minister's most powerful civil service aide. Daniel Gieve is reportedly being considered for the role of Principal Private Secretary, having previously worked with Sir Keir's Chief of Staff, Sue Gray. The paper claims that Mr Gieve has been caught in the crossfire of a proxy war for influence at Number 10.
And as the summer holidays draw to a close, welcome back, Nick, the Mail has highlighted research into how commuters could make their train journeys to and from work more relaxing. It says 35% of passengers involved in the study felt less stressed when they listened to sounds of nature, including flowing rivers, waterfalls and birdsong.
Which is pretty much all I've been doing.
Lucky man.
Sorry to rub that in. And it is... No, really. Lovely to be back. It's now 11 minutes past six.
Welcome to the Pair!
Well, another spectacular opening ceremony to another festival of sport in Paris. It came last night, that opening ceremony, and the Paralympics are now formally underway. Watching carefully for the BBC, our sports correspondent, Sally Hunter. Morning to you, Sally. We'll get to the sport very soon because that's what it's all really about. But wow, that was quite a ceremony, wasn't it?
It was, yes. Tens of thousands of people filling up the Place de la Concorde. We were promised a theme about bodies, disabled bodies in all their forms, and we definitely got that. Lots of reaction this morning on social media from disabled bloggers saying they found it quite moving, actually, to see so many bodies of different types dancing together, moving together on stage. It's not something you see in everyday life. We had Christine and the Queens. We had Keir Starmer watching the GB athletes filing out. We had those blue, white and red fireworks. The cauldron was lit and the stage, I'd say, is set for the next 11 days of sport.
11 days of sport. Day one, what do we see?
Well, we go straight to the velodrome to cycling. Kadina Cox is defending champion in the 500 metre time trial. Now, in previous games, she has gone in athletics as well. Injuries prevented her doing two sports, so she will be really keen, I know, to get that gold medal in the bag. And Daphne Schrager also, she's double world champion, but she's never competed at Paralympic Games before. She's one of 81 debutantes this time, a good medal chance as well. Wheelchair rugby is a very brutal sport that we all love to watch. GB are defending champions in that, but they were telling me before that the competition has really increased this time. There are about seven or eight teams in contention for that medal, so they'll have a battle on their hands. We also have wheelchair basketball. Terry Bywater, we saw last night, is the flag bearer for GB, is part of that squad. And Rachel Chung will make history in badminton as the first female British badminton player to compete at the Paralympic Games. So those are just a few of the highlights of day one underway. There are 22 gold medals up for grabs today.
Exciting time. Sally Hunter, enjoy it all. Thanks for joining us from Paris.
It is 14 minutes past six. The world's most important and one of the most difficult relationships is under the spotlight again today as the US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan is on the final day of his trip to China. On the agenda for Mr. Sullivan and his Chinese counterparts, China's support for Russia and tensions in Asia. Laura Bicker is our China correspondent. Laura, let's start with China, Russia and Ukraine, of key concern to the United States.
Yeah, I mean, this is their latest attempt to try to persuade China and Chinese companies to stop supplying components to Russia that it can use in its war in Ukraine. The Americans genuinely believe that if they can cut off that supply, they will be able to kind of cut off Russia's war machine. However, China refutes that. China says America's adding fuel to the fire, that it does not understand China's relationship with Russia. So it's a real key point of contention. But Johnny, within the last 24 hours, what we have learned is there has managed to be some kind of an agreement between the two sides on key points. The first is there's going to be a big call between President Biden and President Xi in the coming days. Now, that may lay the groundwork for a final meeting between the two presidents before President Biden leaves office. The second thing we've learned, and this is key, is there's going to be a call between military generals. Now, for the first time since 2016, a national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, has met a major general here in China. That is a sign of just how important both sides see this military-to-military communication, especially when it comes to those flashpoints in the South China Sea, like Taiwan Strait, because those two militaries are coming so close to one another that there's this fear of miscalculation.
Laura, thanks very much indeed. Laura Bicker, our correspondent in China there.
16 minutes past six. Will Baines here with us in the studio with the morning's business news. And NVIDIA, now puzzle for us. Shares falling, earnings more than doubling.
This is sort of the problem you have, I suppose, when you're one of the best performing companies on the planet. It's all about expectations and what people expected from you. So even when you do well by anybody's measurement, sometimes they can miss the expectation. We'll try and explain a little bit more with Simon French of Panmure Liberum with us this morning. Simon, morning.
Good morning.
Try and explain that.
Well, you're right that Wall Street expectations were for revenue in the second quarter of $28 billion. And actually, they exceeded that, breaching $30 billion for the first time. And that was up, as Nick suggested, up 122% on the year. But such are the lofty expectations for this stock, not just as a single company, but its broader economic impact, which Chief Executive Jensen Huang is talking about, it, you know, generative AI transforming every industry around the world, which is a pretty bold claim. If you're going to raise expectations that high, then you've got to keep growing at spectacular rates. Mm. And there were just some signs around the edges in the numbers that that rate of growth was starting to slow. Their current AI chip, Hopper, is selling well, but the next one, the next generation, Blackwell, has faced some production delays, and that perhaps is one of the reasons why Wall Street After Hours sold off the stock.
Right, because this was one of the questions we were trying to answer a couple of weeks ago, weren't we, when global stocks were wobbling too. A lot of people saying that tech, full stop, particularly riding this AI wave, mm-hmm. that perhaps people had got ahead of themselves a little bit. How much of that in this reaction, I suppose, that Nick was talking about to NVIDIA's number, how much of that is about NVIDIA itself, the company, and how much of it is that more broadly, this expectation that perhaps tech has got a little bit over its skis?
I think it's a more broad assessment than just NVIDIA. There have been some big claims, as I said, on the impact of generative AI around the world. Theoretically, yes, but in terms of the use cases, the practical use cases and how they can make firms more efficient, more economies more efficient, challenge some of the problems we talk about every day in terms of public finances, economic growth, those are big claims that haven't yet been proven. But I think there's a broader issue here around stock market leadership in the United States. NVIDIA is 6% of the S&P, the headline US stock market. It's up 167%, the stock price on the year. There's pretty narrow leadership of the stock market by a small number of tech firms, and that makes disappointment in what they're claiming and their growth rates having big market implications.
And the other challenge, the other thing in the back of investors' minds, isn't it, is that election in November in the United States, because they're right on the kind of precipice of every tug of war about what they would do with trade in China, for example. We were just hearing Laura Bicker talk about that kind of issue. Companies like this are right in the spotlight on issues like that.
They are, and to think that the US presidential election won't be not just fought on social media and through technology, but also has big ramifications for how that is regulated, not just social media, but also the ability of some of the generative AI tools to destroy and then create jobs. So we have centuries of data that, you know, technological innovation does destroy jobs, which is acutely political. It creates them, but politicians don't always treat those two exactly the same.
No, going to be an interesting... A couple of those companies are going to be really good kind of bellwethers, aren't they, going forward? More from Simon shortly, but let's turn away from the stock market itself and to a warning that, well, it came from the stock market originally, but it's much more closer to home, around the price of milk, because one of the world's biggest providers, suppliers of dairy products, Arla, the UK's largest supplier as well, warned that uncertainty in supply chain shortages were hitting the sector and that prices of milk could rise as a result. Abby Reader is the deputy president of the National Farmers Union Cymru and is herself a dairy farmer. Abby, morning.
Good morning.
What are those uncertainties and shortages then that Arla are pointing to?
It's been quite a difficult year for farmers across the board, regardless of whether you're a dairy or some other sector. We've had some very changeable weather, which has been challenging for grass growth, challenging for other crops that we may grow to either feed or bed our livestock. So that hasn't helped. Off the back of that, we're still going through the back end of some extraordinary agricultural inflation that came about post-COVID and post-Brexit. And all of those combined has really depressed confidence in the dairy sector. So we're seeing cows that just aren't really delivering the volumes of milk that we usually see. Plus, there's a slightly depressed demand globally at the moment.
Right, that was something Arla pointed to. I mean, is that being borne out then in demand that you're seeing? People choosing alternative, you know, whether it be almond milk or whatever it is, other milk alternatives. Is that having an impact on the amount that, I don't know, that you're being asked to supply?
No, market intelligence is really suggesting that people are looking for alternatives. People's patterns are changing, so they're tending to look more at cheese, products like that, than they would perhaps at what we would call liquid milk, so buying milk in a bottle. I think as well, people are just generally feeling the pinch of the cost of living. And when you start looking at perhaps more luxury items, you might want to term it like cheese, like yogurt, like the various confectionaries or certain ready meals that you will find milk products in, people are just being a lot more cautious about what they're buying.
Mm. And so what's the outlook then? Arla warning that, you know, could be a slight creep up in price. I mean, is that what you think, that the price of milk might climb, and over what kind of period?
Well, what we're seeing, we've had a depressed milk yield now over this sort of spring and summer, and that is because the sun hasn't shone, the grass isn't great. We need sunlight to create sugar in the grass. There isn't much there, so the cows aren't very happy and the milk yield is a bit depressed. What Arla, I think, are suggesting now is that actually the latter half of this year, things are looking up. They are starting to see a turnaround in product buying. And actually, as we approach Christmas, dare I say that word, people are going to start buying more dairy. So there's a bit more confidence coming back into this industry now. And when Arla are talking about price, they're definitely looking at putting the price up for their farmers more so than they would be for consumers. And that will help drive the confidence and help farmers really start to push for extra milk to make sure it's there for everybody.
Abby, thanks so much for your time this morning. That's Abby Reader, the Deputy President of the National Farmers Union Cymru there. Let's return to Simon French of Panmure Liberum, because Simon, an interesting company reporting results yesterday, CrowdStrike, the company that people might remember, the IT software company that was at the centre of that global IT meltdown a month or so ago. It was having to speak to its investors yesterday. What did it tell them?
Well, the headline financial data was actually quite positive, with revenue up 32% year on year. But the shares disappointed. They were down more than 4% after hours. And why? Well, you mentioned this cybersecurity update that the crash actually quite significant parts of the world economy, the airline industry particularly impacted their booking system out for multiple hours. And there was suggestions from CEO George Kurtz that there was impacts on that, on what they're likely to be able to deliver in terms of financial results in the second half of the year. Why? Because many of the subscriptions that are being renewed, some of their clients that were impacted are saying, well, we want a discount on that. So some of their line of sight on revenue are being pared back. So they're paring back expectations.
Right. Sounds like a few months of negotiations for the firm there. Going to be interesting ones.
Not just contractual, but of course legal as well, with class action lawsuits in the US.
Something we'll drop back into in this slot, I'm sure. Simon French, thanks so much for your time. Now, something we were talking about on the programme yesterday, the British Medical Association and that call on the government to ban flavoured and disposable vapes. You might remember they claim that children are being targeted with the colours, branding and flavours of some of these products. Well, Marcus Saxton is the chief executive of Totally Wicked, an electronic cigarette company. He's also the chairman of the Independent British Vape Trade Association. Marcus, morning.
Morning, Will.
What was your reaction to that call?
Well, we certainly share and applaud the emotional call out. I'm a parent, as many people are, and it's appalling that children are gaining access to these transformative products designed for adults. But we're equally concerned by some of the specific detail that demonstrates a real lack of understanding on the BMA's behalf around the 5.6 million vapers, the vast majority of which were smokers. And therefore, what we're trying to balance here is those people, it's been proven over 16 years, these transformative products are enabling them to quit. 47% of them use fruit flavours. And how do we ensure then that we balance the real common goal of reduction of the harm of the known killer of smoking, but ensuring these products don't get into the hands of youth,
but
which
presumably,
is disabled?
If they were smokers, then they presumably like the taste of tobacco. And one of the calls that the BMA is having to is just to say, get rid of the flavours and make these things tobacco only. That seems fair enough, doesn't it?
Well, that would be absolutely demonstrably catastrophic to the adult smoker. So what you've got to imagine, speaking to many smokers, is people are trying to get off this habit that they're addicted to. And actually, they therefore, 47% of them have called out in a survey that's been done since 2010 that they actually use fruit flavours. Why? But, because they're trying to get away from the thing they're addicted to.
But the BMA is arguing that that in itself is quite addictive. And we know that with sugary products, full stop, whether they be drinks or sweets, you know, they are moorish by their nature.
You're right, but I think it's unequivocal now for many, many years that actually smoking, two out of three lifelong smokers will unfortunately die. Vaping is materially safer, but we can say again, is not risk-free if you don't smoke. But if there's 5.6 million vapers, the vast majority were smokers, this is a materially safer product that therefore drives real societal benefit.
And if the government took this on as a policy, what would it do to the industry? What would it do to your company?
Well, certainly we're talking with them prior to the change in government. There was already legislation in place that hopefully we'll get some confirmation on to ban disposable vapes, which are certainly more attractive to use, albeit have played a role with adult smokers. It would certainly have a significant effect, but we hope.
Do you think that would be sensible to get rid of disposable vapes?
Only on the basis of if these things have been the more attractive to use, then let's stop that and move on and get back to our knitting, which is the important bit of how do we ensure these products are only for adult smokers, which the vast majority are.
Marcus Saxton, the boss of Totally Wicked, the e-cigarette company, and chairman of the Independent British Vape Trade Association. Thanks so much for your time.
And thank you, Will. 27 minutes past six. Here's Gary with the sports news. Morning, Gary.
Yeah, morning to you. The second test between England and Sri Lanka starts at 11 o'clock this morning. England won up in the series, and Jonathan Agnew looks ahead.
With the sun due to shine for at least the first 4 days, Sri Lanka will be confident of building on their improving performance at Old Trafford. That they still lost in 4 days is largely due to poor starts to both innings and an excellent 100 by Jamie Smith, but they served a reminder that Sri Lankan cricket can be tenacious. With Wood ruled out of the series, Ollie Stone returns after a three-year absence through injury, an issue that's limited his 13-year first-class career to just 51 games and three tests. But when fit, he generates express pace and will be very much in England's thoughts for next year's Ashes. The green tinge to the Lord's pitch should also be to his liking.
There were seven matches in the second round of the League Cup. League Two Wimbledon knocked Ipswich out on penalties, although the Premier League side had six players making their debut. West Ham beat Bournemouth 1-0. Newcastle knocked Nottingham Forest out 4-3 on penalties. Wolves defeated Burnley 2-0. Southampton won 5-3 at Cardiff, and Wickham beat Swansea 1-0. England have two international matches next month, and caretaker manager Lee Carsley will name his squad today, and John Murray reports.
Today marks an important first step towards Lee Carsley possibly becoming Gareth Southgate's permanent successor. It'll be intriguing to see if the Arsenal defender Ben White returns to the fold, having made himself unavailable under Southgate. But it's likely this squad will look very similar to the one that went all the way to the Euros final just 46 days ago. Jude Bellingham won't be in it, though. The Real Madrid star is injured. And Carsley has certainly had decisions to make over whether to recall big names like Jack Grealish, James Maddison and Marcus Rashford, who missed out on Germany, or whether to turn to players he knows from his role as England's under-21 coach, such as Chelsea's Noni Madueke and Levi Colwill, Rico Lewis of Manchester City, Nottingham Forest's Morgan Gibbs-White or Morgan Rogers of Aston Villa. And West Ham's Maximilian Kilman might also have been in the thoughts of the interim coach.
At the US Tennis Open, Britain's Harriet Dart lost her second round match, and after a spectacular opening ceremony, as we were hearing on the programme about 10 minutes ago, the Paralympics gets underway today. Plenty more cricket then coming up, and I'll be speaking to the new England captain, Ollie Pope, at 8:25.
Look forward to that, Gary. Now, Rory Stewart would like to enlighten us about ignorance.
Knowledge has transformed our understanding of the universe and ourselves. But I'm here to argue that ignorance is just as important.
Every new creative endeavour basically begins in ignorance.
A new series exploring the power of ignorance from art to science to politics.
Just to have in the back of your mind that whatever I believe may in fact be wrong, because that opens me up then to being receptive to other viewpoints.
The long history of ignorance from Confucius to QAnon, with me, Rory Stewart, on BBC Radio 4. Available now on BBC Sounds.
Time now is 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson. And Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
Retailers are calling for tougher action against vendors who sell stolen goods bought from shoplifters. The British Retail Consortium has warned of a worrying new trend of unscrupulous shopkeepers and market traders buying stolen items and selling them on to consumers. A BBC News investigation has uncovered examples of this type of trade. Retailers say they want more police action to tackle the problem. The head of the United Nations has called for an immediate end to major operation by Israeli security forces in the occupied West Bank. A statement from Antonio Guterres said an explosive situation was being made even more dangerous. Palestinian officials say at least 10 people have been killed during what Israel describes as counter-terror raids. Ministers are considering placing restrictions on smoking outdoors as part of a drive to phase out tobacco. As first reported by The Sun, smoking could be banned in pub gardens and outside hospitals and sports grounds. The Department of Health and Social Care said it didn't comment on leaks, but it was looking at a range of measures to make Britain smoke-free. A lawyer for the Telegram founder Pavel Durov has described the decision by the French judge to put the billionaire under formal investigation as totally absurd. Mr. Durov has been barred from leaving France. He's accused of failing to curb illegal content on the messaging service, including images of child sex abuse. The Paralympic Games were officially opened last night at a spectacular ceremony in the Place de la Concorde. Like the Olympics last month, it was the first time the Paralympic opening ceremony had taken place away from the main stadium. Today, medals are up for grabs in track cycling, swimming and taekwondo. And a network of wildlife charities is calling for beavers to be released into rivers across England and Wales. The Wildlife Trust say the beaver is a keystone species that can bring huge benefits to nature, but governments have failed to put in place steps to return them to the wild.
Alan, thank you. 28 minutes to 7. More now on that worrying new trend. Retailers, a warning, is fueling the growth in shoplifting. Criminals are acting like wholesalers, stealing to order not to sell for a few quid down the pub, but to other shopkeepers. The man behind the story is the BBC's Jim Connolly, who's been investigating shoplifting in the great city of Leeds. Morning to you, Jim. We're going to hear your report in full at 8:10. But listening to the man that you focus on, a regular shoplifter called Ross, describe what he does, really shines a light on the fact that it is not quite what people imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. We spent time with Ross. It was quite unusual to get hold of someone like him. I've been covering shoplifting now for about a year, and to get hold of someone who is an active, or until recently, very active shoplifter, arguably one of the most prolific in Leeds, was quite rare. So having that time with him was really interesting. And we started to unpick what he did on a day-to-day basis. We spent the full day with him going round, talking about the shops he entered. And then we got onto the fact that ultimately, he can only operate if someone's willing to buy stolen goods. So we asked him where he was selling the stuff to, and he got out his phone and he started to show us messages on his phone. And the messages were from a middleman asking for specific items. And it was really specific. It was like bottles of alcohol, cleaning products, butter. And there was this list that kept coming through. And at first I was like, well, that's quite shocking that this guy is actually directing you in what to steal. And I was like, where else do you sell it to? And then at that point, he told us something that really took us all back. Everyone that was there collecting the material on the day just sort of went, I can't believe he's just said that. Because he turned round to us and said that he sold some of the items that he stole to other shops. So he was going around the sort of big shops in the city centre, stealing items, and then he was taking them to other retailers who were looking through his bag, offering him a price, giving him some money, and then using that as stock in their shops.
He flippantly described himself as the cheapest wholesaler in the city, didn't he? Now, yeah. One thing behind this, Jim, it's sometimes said, indeed new ministers in this new government say, is that the law treats shoplifting below £200 in a different way to that of a higher value. In the conversations you were having with Ross and with others, does he suggest that makes a difference?
I think that's commonly known amongst shoplifters. It's commonly known amongst the shopkeepers. They're really frustrated about this. The police would argue that they don't treat it differently, but I think if you speak to the kind of experience of the shop workers and the shop owners we've spoken to, they would argue that definitely that £200 limit where shoplifting is treated differently is a problem, and they feel there's just no point reporting it. We spoke to the British Retail Consortium about Ross's claims about this him stealing to order and him stealing and selling to shops. And as part of that, they said, yes, there is this worrying new trend and we're worried about what you've found. But they also said that the official figures that are put out just don't come anywhere close to picking up how big a problem shoplifting is. They think the official figures that we report on all the time only pick up about a third of shoplifting. So two-thirds of it is just basic.
It's doubled in the last year, even according to the official figures. We've got to leave it there, Jim, but we're going to hear your report in full at 8:10. And shortly after 7 o'clock, after the 7 o'clock news button, we'll hear from the representative of the small shopkeeper as well.
It is 24 minutes to 7, a dangerous development fueling an already explosive situation. The words of the UN Secretary General about the Israeli military operation in the West Bank, Palestinian territory occupied by Israel, which has seen at least 11 Palestinians killed in what Israel calls a counter-terrorism operation. It's the biggest military operation there in 20 years, all against the background, of course, of the continuing conflict in Gaza. Yolande Nel is our correspondent in Jerusalem. Yolande, can you bring us up to date? Because I think there have been more deaths announced this morning, haven't there?
Yeah, we're trying to get a figure from the Palestinian Health Ministry. The latest I heard is at least 14 people have been killed by Israeli forces since the start of this operation. But from the Israeli military, the latest statement talks about how they had an exchange of fire with members of Palestinian armed groups in a mosque in the Nur Shams urban refugee camp in Tulkarm. And they say that they've killed five members of Palestinian armed groups, including the local leader in that camp, who they say was nicknamed Abu Shuja, and they link him to different operations that have been carried out, including the shooting last June, which killed an Israeli citizen. Otherwise, from the Palestinian media, they talk about, you know, continuing raids going on in Nablus early this morning, Israeli military forces entering with several vehicles in another part of Tulkarm. The people there are saying that the Israeli forces have been raiding a lot of local people's homes. It's causing panic and damage. And colleagues in Jenin told me that, you know, they also heard about more raids happening during the night, and that Israeli forces this morning are still surrounding the two hospitals there.
And Yolande, I mean, this comes against the background, as I mentioned, not just of Gaza, but also very heightened tensions across the West Bank in the months since October the 7th.
Definitely. And there has been a sort of, you know, surge in violence in the West Bank that's taken place in parallel to what's happened in Gaza, although on a smaller scale. And it's involved like more than 640 Palestinians being killed, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. Israel says it's been really stepping up its action against Palestinian armed groups, particularly Hamas and Islamic Jihad. But of course, we've also seen extremist settlers mounting these vigilante attacks against Palestinian communities.
Yolande Nell in Jerusalem, thank you very much.
It is now 22 minutes to 7. Britain could see a rise in far-right populism, just as happened in Germany and France. That danger is something the Prime Minister says occupies his mind. He was speaking in Berlin after talks about resetting relations with Germany and the rest of the EU. This morning he's meeting with France's President Macron in Paris. One of the reporters he was talking to last night was the BBC's chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman.
Keir Starmer was asked in that exchange with journalists about lots of different things, and on some things he wasn't very talkative. And on this, it was clear that, in his own words, this issue has occupied his mind over recent weeks. You know, he's not been Prime Minister that long, still less than 2 months, and the riots here in the UK were one of, well, were the biggest issue that he's had to confront so far, probably. And it is clear that he's been thinking about it. He talked about the snake oil of populism, and he said that he had looked at what's happened in France with the rise of the National Front, the National Rally as it now is, and in Germany, and thought about not just how democracies and people who are not of the far right should respond, but also how progressives, as he called them, centre-left leaders, should respond. And he said, in his mind, the best response to what he calls the snake oil of populism is delivery. He basically says that the best way he thinks to respond to far right and populist politics is to govern well. And that is clearly something that at the start of what he hopes will be a long premiership, a new prime minister is thinking about finding the best way to do.
Does it also explain why he thinks a resetting of relations, not just with the EU as a whole, but with individual nations, Germany yesterday, France today, matters as well? He's got to deliver to ordinary working people.
Certainly, and all of the language in Germany yesterday, I'm sure we'll have the same in France today, about why he wants a reset in relations with European member states, the big ones in particular, but also the European Union in general. It was all couched in terms of delivering for working people. Now, I think that's partly just because that's the kind of way that Keir Starmer talks across the piece, but I think it's also, as you say, because he's trying to find ways to smooth particular issues in the UK's post-Brexit settlement, which he thinks are causing friction for businesses and friction for people. But he is constrained, as his predecessors from the Conservative Party have been, in how far he can go in altering particular frictions by the fundamentals of the UK's post-Brexit relationship, the issues of single market membership, of customs union membership, which he says are just not up for question. They are staying as they are. And I think it's still unclear, even for all the warm words yesterday between Keir Starmer and his German counterpart, and I'm sure we'll have the same with Emmanuel Macron today, I think it's still unclear how wide this reset really can go, whether it is more than just a kind of rhetorical sense that both the UK and Germany and France have a lot more goodwill now. But this treaty with Germany that Keir Starmer announced he will be negotiating yesterday, he says it will be done within 6 months. So we will find out before very long how substantial this actually is going to prove to be.
Henry Zeffman in Paris, thank you for joining us.
It is 18 minutes to 7. Let's take another look at the papers. A rather depressing but important, and I should say rather startling, story on the front page of The Guardian. UK youths experience happiness recession is the headline. More 15-year-olds are reporting low life satisfaction in Britain than almost anywhere else in Europe amidst what experts are describing as a happiness recession, says The Guardian. For British teenagers in the UK, 25% of 15-year-olds reported low life satisfaction, compared with 7% of Dutch children of the same age. It's the lowest level among any of the countries surveyed. And it highlights, The Guardian highlights, the change between 2021 and 2000.
and 9, significantly lower, it says, in the recent years for children aged between 10 and 15.
A leak to the Sun has produced a happiness recession in that paper. No cigarettes and alcohol is its front page headline. It has got news of a row going on in government about a possible extension of anti-smoking laws. Remember that Keir Starmer said that he would continue to pursue the policy that Rishi Sunak set out about phasing out smoking and make it illegal, indeed, over time. This is a suggestion that smoking will be banned not just inside pubs and restaurants, but outside them, in pub gardens in particular. The butt stops here is a headline inside the Sun, and it has picked up news, no doubt. Who knows who links to them, but news of a memo from the business department fearing the financial cost to the hospitality sector if people are stopped from smoking in pub gardens. And in its editorial, it says, how many of us get cancer from a whiff of secondhand smoke in a pub garden? For our pubs, though, it is a death knell, battered by soaring costs and dwindling punters, especially since the indoor smoking ban. Thousands of pubs have already closed. And not so much a leak, but the failure of government to close down a possible suggestion for a tax rise in the budget. It leads to other Conservative supporting newspapers, The Mail and The Telegraph. Motorists face fuel hike under Starmer's squeeze. Fuel duty could be next in the tax grab. They haven't got news of that. What they've got is the refusal of government insiders to rule out an increase in fuel duty, which, remember, has not risen for many, many years.
Months of budget speculation to come. It is 16 minutes to 7. One headline: police forces are being urged to crack down on dishonest vendors and market traders who buy goods from shoplifters in order to sell them on. Now, today, the UK's most productive onshore wind farm on one of the Shetland Islands has come on stream. It can generate enough electricity to run 500,000 homes. A cool £1 billion has been spent on the 103 turbines and the cable to send power back to mainland Scotland. But it is raising questions about how easy the switch to renewable energy will be, as James Cook reports.
I'm in the centre of Shetland's biggest island, looking out over a rugged, blustery moorland of green and brown, dotted with the odd purple thistle. And on the horizon are dozens of towering white wind turbines, their blades slicing through the sky and their tips actually disappearing into the low cloud that hangs over the land. They're part of the Viking wind farm, which at full capacity can generate almost 50 times as much energy as Shetland itself actually needs. We drive up to the turbines with Alistair Phillips-Davis, chief executive of the operator, SSE.
Shetland's got great wind resource. This is the first of the really big wind farms that may be built here. There'll be more projects to come. If we think about the targets the government have set for 2030, we need to do a lot more of these projects, a lot more offshore wind projects as well, to make sure that we can decarbonise the energy system, but also importantly, get security of supply.
So does that mean that people will have to be prepared for more of the countryside to look like this?
Yeah, I think so, but equally, we're here to consult on that.
To get Viking's electricity to the British grid, SSE has built a 160-mile-long undersea cable from Shetland to Knowse Head near Wick on the Scottish mainland. Viking is far from the only renewable project now feeding into the grid, but carrying all this power through Scotland and into England and Wales comes at a cost. More and bigger pylons marching across the land. I'm back on the mainland now in Aberdeenshire, where I can see purple heather on the mountains, green trees in the forests, and the yellow of the wheat and barley shimmering in the fields. This land can't have changed much since Lewis Grassic Gibbon described it in his classic novel Sunset Song around a century ago. But it has changed a little. On the ridge above me, there are wind turbines spinning around, and people who live here are worried about what might come next.
On the field, we have not a pipes and drums, pipe band.
At the Glen Burvey show, Kate Matthews is campaigning against plans to erect pylons in Aberdeenshire and Angus.
We're hugely worried about the industrialisation of our countryside. We live in one of the most beautiful parts of the world, and we're looking at thousands of acres being taken up with essentially industrial projects. There are campaigns in Essex, there are campaigns in Lincolnshire, there are campaigns in Wales. The Lake District doesn't know about their pylons yet. Yorkshire doesn't know about their pylons yet. The rest of the UK doesn't know what's coming.
Up the coast in Aberdeen, they're worried too, for a different reason. This remains the heart of the UK's oil and gas industry. Steve Bowyer, North Sea General Manager of oil producer EnQuest, says the government's windfall tax on the industry, combined with an end to certain tax breaks for investment, has had a chilling effect.
We as an industry are very concerned. There's a risk of causing irreparable damage to the industry and the UK economy if we don't see proper engagement, collaboration and action to put in place an appropriate fiscal regime.
The government insists it will protect North Sea jobs for decades to come. It's also promising that greener power projects, such as Viking, will bring down bills. But back in Shetland, many islanders are unconvinced. Morag Lyle is chair of Environment and Transport at Shetland Islands Council.
Well, people are looking out their windows at these huge turbines that are producing far more power than we could possibly ever use, and at the same time having to wonder whether or not they can put their own heating on because of the cost of electricity here. So they're justifiably angry that there's so little benefit to the islands from these projects.
Shetland proves that going green is not without its challenges. And there are sure to be many more of them as the renewables revolution rolls on.
James Cook there reporting from the Shetlands.
It's now 11 minutes to 7. The risk of dementia could be lowered by as much as a third by using medication designed to treat type 2 diabetes. That's a striking finding of a Korean study, just one of several involving repurposing drugs. What is the potential for this to impact the treatments which may one day be available on the NHS? That's something we can discuss with the Executive Director of Research at Alzheimer's Research UK, Dr. Susan Kohlhaas. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Let's begin with this study, which I know you've looked at rather than being involved in. Does it prove a link, or does it just suggest something that much more research is needed for?
Yeah, so this is a large observational study, so it doesn't prove cause and effect, but it just suggests that actually this is a treatment to look at as a potential treatment for preventing dementia.
And does it tell us what the mechanism might be?
No, unfortunately, this study doesn't do that either. So there are the authors of the study look at a few different potential mechanisms, but much more work is needed before we determine exactly what mechanism this may or may not be working by as well.
But there does seem to be a trend in research around Alzheimer's for repurposing existing drugs. Does that have more potential than drugs that are being specially designed?
Yeah, I don't think there's a right or wrong way of developing treatments. And what we do know is that people with Alzheimer's desperately, or in dementia more widely, desperately need more treatments. We have had some success with treatments that have been developed from scratch, but also about a third of the drugs that are being developed and tested in clinical trials are repurposed from other conditions. And that can be really beneficial for a few ways. We know the risk profile of those drugs, so we don't have to do quite as many clinical studies on them as we would with a completely new treatment. And
yet that doesn't necessarily mean they get a license, does it? Because we were talking, I think, to Alzheimer's Research just last week, weren't we, about lecanemab, the fact that it does have a positive impact. But NICE, the body that decides whether drugs can be used by the NHS, decided in the end the costs were simply too high to justify it.
That's exactly right. So as with any drug, repurposed drugs will need to go through clinical trials processes to make sure that they're safe and effective. And then they'll have to go through, they also tend to have to go through a process to make sure they're cost effective as well. But if they are repurposed, already being used on the NHS, some of them can be generic as well. They can be a little bit cheaper to use.
I know this is a how long is a piece of string type question, but as you look at the research that you're seeing now, how many years away do you think we are from the NHS prescribing quite regularly drugs that can not stop Alzheimer's, but certainly slow it?
That is a long as a piece of string question. I think we... we're in the process of finding treatments that remove the proteins that build up in Alzheimer's disease, but we also need to develop treatments that protect the brain from further damage and restore brain function. And you can see treatments coming through in each of those categories. And if we can start to use those and develop those in combination, we could be at a place where we're slowing and stopping the progression of Alzheimer's disease.
Dr. Colhouse of Alzheimer's Research UK, thanks for joining us.
It's 7 minutes to seven, back in blustery March. It feels a long time ago, doesn't it? As part of our series about the River Avon in the West Country, you might remember Emily Knight went out with Emma Brisdian from the Rivers Trust trying to spot a rumoured community of beavers on the river.
We haven't had them in the UK for like 400 years. We hunted them to extinction a long time ago, and slowly they've been reintroduced. But of course, there are people who sometimes feel that restoration's not happening fast enough and we need the beaver. Perhaps a few have been reintroduced outside of enclosures under cover of darkness.
Guerrilla rewilding.
Precisely.
Well, the beaver battle goes on for some. The Wildlife Trusts, a federation of 46 different wildlife conservation charities, is calling for licences to release beavers into the wild. At the moment, they go into enclosures and government funding to support that. Rob Stoneman is Director of Landscape Recovery at the Wildlife Trusts. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why is it so important that beavers go into the wild?
I mean, it's really important. You know, beavers are a fantastic animal. Think of a sort of large puppy-sized guinea pig type animal with this incredible flat tail. So, I mean, A, they're actually our cuddliest mammal as well. They've got the densest fur. So, A, it'd be fantastic to have beavers back in our landscape. But those beavers do all their beavery activities of creating dams, of coppicing, of ditching, create these marvellous wetlands, so full of wetland flowers and dragonflies and damselflies and frogs and toads and so on. And so they're restoring nature mostly for free, but in doing so, they slow the flow. So instead of storing water in our front room during these floods, which we know are getting worse as a result of climate change, we store water safely in beaver wetlands, and they reduce water pollution in our rivers by filtering that water through the dams and ponds of these wetlands and effectively creating water treatment works. So our cuddliest mammal is both our nature restorer, our flood management engineer, our water treatment supervisor, all virtually for free, and we need them back in our rivers and lakes.
Rob, you're clearly a beaver fan. Not everyone is so keen, though, are they? Because there is concern over their dams blocking fish migration, the impact on the landscape, and localised flooding as well, although you say it'll keep the water out of our living rooms.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important to recognise these legitimate concerns, and the Devon Wildlife Trust ran a beaver trial, actually, ironically, on the River Otter down in Devon. And what we did in that beaver trial is to look at how we what do we need to do to coexist with beavers on our rivers? So it's things like, you know, if farmers get a field flooded, then let's pay that farmer for having beavers on their land, so that instead of being a sort of bit of an irritation, it's actually part of their business. So that's good. If we've got special trees that we need to protect, we can put a bit of wire mesh around them to protect them from being coppiced by the beaver. So all of these local problems can be resolved, providing we've got staffing on the ground to sort that out. So we in the Wildlife Trust and National Trust and Beaver Trust and others are committed to providing that. But obviously we need government support to come up with a very sensible and common sense licensing regime so we can get these fantastic, charismatic animals back into our lakes and rivers as soon as possible.
Beaver fan Rob Stoneman, thank you very much indeed.
Aren't we all? It is 3 minutes to seven, and the weather this morning with Matt Taylor.
Thank you very much, Nick. Good morning. Well, it's been a warm week so far across some eastern areas. We got to 30.1 Celsius in Cambridge yesterday. It's been rather cloudy and wet at times to the north and the west, but we might switch things around a little bit later this week through Friday and into the weekend. It's northern and western areas who will see the best of the drier and the sunnier weather. Temperatures, though, have fallen away. A bit fresher out there, about 3-4 degrees cooler than it was around 24 hours ago. But if you're in southern England, the Channel Islands, Midlands, East Anglia, North East England, beautiful start to your Thursday. Blue skies overhead. There will be some fair weather cloud building up as we go through the day. Far northeast of England could see an isolated shower, but the vast majority still dry, still some good spells of strong sunshine around. And even though temperatures down on yesterday, still pleasantly warm, 20 to 24 degrees. For Wales and northwest England, as well as the Isle of Man, a lot more cloudy around first thing. There are some outbreaks of rain or drizzle around, and there will be a few showers through the day, but the cloud will break up a bit more readily, and during the afternoon, increasing amounts of sunshine, temperatures around 16 to 19 degrees. For Northern Ireland, the cloud will be well broken at times to allow some sunshine through, but the cloud will also build up where we do have it to produce a few showers on and off through the day. Some of you, though, avoid them altogether. Highs around 15 to 18 degrees. And across Scotland, quite a windy day in the far north. The wind's falling a little bit lighter further south. Lots of cloud around this morning. Best of the sunshine really to the far northeast. Some outbreaks of rain across some western areas, but the cloud will break up. Sunny spells, one or two showers into the afternoon. Highs around 15 to 18. A bit fresher again tonight with lows of 7 to 11 degrees, but most dry tomorrow.
Thanks, Matt.
80 years ago, the Bengal famine took the lives of around 3 million people in British India in a forgotten part of World War II history. Now join me, Kavita Puri, as I travel to Bengal to hear the remarkable testimonies of some of the last survivors.
I lived on eating whatever edible leaves, roots I could find.
We were given only some boiled rice.
Our parents didn't eat. I remember that.
A new episode of 3 Million on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. This morning at 9:30.
Coming up in the next half hour, could smoking be banned outdoors in places like pubs and children's playgrounds? And what would that mean for the hospitality sector? We'll be discussing that. We'll be discussing shoplifting. A man who claims he's the cheapest wholesaler in Leeds because he shoplifts to order for other shops.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Johnny Diamond. It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 29th of August. The headlines this morning. The head of the UN has called for an immediate halt to a major Israeli military operation, which is continuing for a second day in the occupied West Bank. This morning, the IDF said it had killed five Palestinian gunmen in a mosque. Retailers have called for more police action to stop dishonest traders buying shoplifted goods in order to sell them on. Smoking could be banned in outdoor settings such as pub gardens under measures being considered by the government. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on Israel to halt its military operation in the north of the occupied West Bank immediately. Palestinian health officials say 11 people have been killed by Israeli forces since yesterday. In the past hour, the Israeli military announced details of an incident in Tulkarm, saying its troops killed five Palestinian fighters inside a mosque on the second day of the operation. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell.
With the war in Gaza still raging, Israel's biggest operation in the West Bank in some 20 years is causing international alarm. These dangerous developments are fueling an already explosive situation, the head of the UN said. The EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, warned against a war extension from Gaza. Palestinians say there have been casualties and damage to homes and infrastructure in Jenin, Tulkarm, Nablus and Tubas. The Israeli military says it's carrying out a counter-terrorism operation and that it's made arrests and seized weapons. This morning it said it had killed five members of Palestinian armed groups in Tulkarm, including their local leader, who'd been hiding in a mosque.
Retailers have warned of what they call a worrying new trend of unscrupulous shopkeepers and market traders buying stolen items from shoplifters and selling them on to consumers. A BBC News investigation has also managed to uncover examples of this type of trade. Organisations representing retailers say tougher action to tackle the trend is vital. Jim Connolly has this report.
Shoplifting is at the highest level since records began 20 years ago. More than 430,000 offences were recorded last year across England and Wales. But the industry body, the British Retail Consortium, estimates the figure only reflects about a third of retail crimes. It's also told the BBC it wanted more action to tackle a new trend where unscrupulous shops and traders buy stolen goods from shoplifters to sell on. We've seen evidence of this from a shop owner and heard directly from a shoplifter who until recently used to do it himself. To protect his identity, we're only using his first name, Ross.
I have my bag full of stuff. I'd know which shop to go to sell it on. And, they didn't want to get seen on the camera. They'd take me into the back room. I lay it out on the floor. We discuss a price and I'm out of there with the money. It's economics, isn't it? I suppose I was the cheapest wholesaler.
The man said he turned to crime to fund a crippling addiction to crack cocaine and heroin. He says he's now stopped taking drugs and hasn't stolen for 5 months. The National Police Chief Council told us it was almost impossible to trace the type of goods he used to steal to sell on, but insists its focus is on finding those involved for retail crime and ensuring they're brought to justice. The government is promising new laws to tackle the crime.
Ministers are considering placing restrictions on smoking outdoors in England and Wales as part of a drive to phase out tobacco. As first reported by The Sun, smoking could be banned in pub gardens and outside hospitals and sports grounds. Our political correspondent David Cornock reports.
Rishi Sunak's Conservative government tried to outlaw the sale of cigarettes to anyone born after January 2009, but its bill failed when the election was called. Keir Starmer's administration promised something similar in the King's speech at last month's state opening of Parliament, and it now appears its tobacco and vapes bill will go much further, extending the existing ban on smoking in indoor public places to areas such as pub gardens, outdoor restaurants and sports grounds. The details of any ban are likely to be subject to consultation. The Department of Health and Social Care said it didn't comment on leaks, but it said it was determined to protect children and non-smokers from the harms of secondhand smoking, and it was considering a range of measures to finally make Britain smoke-free.
The founder and chief executive of Telegram, Pavel Durov, has been placed under formal investigation in France as part of a probe into allegations of organised crime on the messaging app. The Russian-born billionaire, who was arrested outside Paris on Saturday, has been granted bail on the condition he remains in France and reports to police twice a week. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Pavel Durov is sometimes described as the Mark Zuckerberg of Russia. He was born there, but he left the country in 2014 and is now a citizen of both France and Dubai. The Telegram messaging platform he founded is currently used by nearly 1 billion people worldwide. The accusations Mr. Durov faces are very serious. They include running a platform to enable illicit transactions by an organised gang, refusing to communicate with authorities, and complicity in the organised criminal distribution of sexual images of children. His lawyer said it was absurd to suggest that he could be implicated in any crime committed on the app. It's unprecedented for the owner of a social media platform to be arrested in this way, and Mr. Durov's detention has fueled a fierce debate online about freedom of speech and accountability.
Power is flowing from the Shetland Isles to mainland Britain for the first time, as what's expected to be the UK's most productive onshore wind farm comes on stream. The operator, SSE, says the 103-turbine project, known as Viking, can generate enough electricity to power nearly 500,000 homes. The switch-on has highlighted some of the challenges posed by the move from fossil fuels to renewable energy, as our Scotland editor James Cook reports from Lerwick.
Shetland is the windiest place in the UK, which is why SSE chose it to host the Viking wind farm, now dominating the skyline in the centre of the archipelago's main island. From here, electricity is carried 160 miles undersea to Caithness, where it joins the mainland grid. The UK government wants all UK electricity to be generated from renewable sources by 2030, but SSE's chief executive, Alistair Phillips-Davis, says that will only happen if planning reform can produce a significant acceleration in onshore and offshore projects. It will also require more and bigger electricity pylons, prompting alarm in some rural communities who worry that a dash to build wind turbines, solar farms and hydrogen plants could mean the mass industrialisation of the British countryside.
The Prime Minister has said European democracies must work together to combat the rise of the far right. As he prepares to meet President Macron in Paris today, Sir Keir Starmer said delivering good government was the best way to deal with what he called the snake oil of populism. More from our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman.
As the Prime Minister seeks warmer relations with Europe, an admission that he is concerned about what he called the challenge of the far right, populism and nationalism. Sir Keir said the issue was something that occupied his time. He told reporters his concern stemmed partly from the disturbances in the UK this summer, but also recent developments in France and Germany, the two countries he's visiting this week. Sir Keir called for a joint discussion about what that means across Europe, including with fellow centre-left leaders. This morning, Sir Keir will meet President Macron at the Élysée, as he continues to pursue his hopes of a reset in relations with Europe.
22 medal events will take place today, the first day of action in the Paralympics following last night's spectacular opening ceremony in Paris. John McFall, a British doctor who's also undertaking astronaut training, carried the Paralympic flag, one of only two flag bearers to represent the whole movement rather than a specific country. With a look at what's ahead today, here's Ed Harry in Paris.
Britain's first gold of the Games might come in cycling. Among those in action at the Velodrome on day one will be Kadina Cox, looking to win the women's combined C4 and C5 500-metre time trial for the third Paralympics in a row. At the pool, Tully Kearney, who won silver in the S5 200 freestyle in Tokyo, will hope to go one better. And in total, a team of 215 athletes is representing Paralympics GB here, with a target of 100 to 140 medals set by UK Sport. With 124 medals, 41 of them gold. They were second in the medal table in Tokyo behind China.
That was Ed Harry in Paris.
Alan, thank you. It is 7:09. Imagine a shoplifter. What do you see? Kids trying it on, perhaps, or someone desperate for money to feed a drug habit, or simply to feed their kids. The reality is rather more complex. Shoplifters are often sent out by gangs to steal to order, acting like wholesalers given shopping lists by other shopkeepers. Our reporter Jim Connolly has been investigating shoplifting over the past year, and this morning reports from Leeds. It's a report we'll hear in full in about an hour's time when he speaks to a man who's been shoplifting for half his life.
Tia Maria, honey, cheese, washing tablets and liquid if you can, please, mate.
Ross showed me his phone and it was full of this. Daily requests to steal to order, all via a middleman. It seemed shocking until he told me where else he sold his stolen goods to. Other shops across the city.
I had my bag full of stuff. I'd know which shop to go to sell it on. And, they didn't want to get seen on the camera. They'd take me into the back room. I lay it out on the floor. We'd discuss a price. And I'm out of there with the money.
It sounds crazy to say that, doesn't it?
It's the economics, isn't it? I suppose I was the cheapest wholesaler at the end of the day.
Well, we'll hear from a chief constable in an hour's time who's had the most success combating shoplifting. But let's hear first from a body which represents those small shopkeepers, some of whom seem to be encouraging shoplifters from their others. I've been speaking to Andrew Goodacre. He's chief executive of the British Independent Retailers Association.
I'm not surprised. It's something that retailers, large and small, will talk about a lot. There are these repeat perpetrators, offenders who are very skilled at what they do and clearly find a market in order to offload the goods once they're stolen as well.
Finding a market is one thing. We tend, I think, probably in our minds to think of shoplifters being down the pub or a market stall passing on stolen goods. But by the sounds of it, this is to order, and the orders are often coming from shopkeepers themselves.
Yeah, that piece about the other shops actually knowingly buying stolen goods is depressing and frustrating for law-abiding retailers who have lost those goods. The shopping to order, I guess technology is allowing that to happen. You know, the messaging we can do through our telephones these days and offloading the goods, whether it's through physical shops or market traders or even online marketplaces, there's plenty of those available where people will buy bargains, not knowing that they're stolen in the first place.
Often we think of shoplifting, I suspect, as a crime of desperation, people feeding a drug habit or just desperate to feed their kids. Should we see it in a slightly different way as organised crime that needs to be combated in a way it hasn't been up till now?
Yes, the increase in the level of crime being seen, I think the value on it now is over £2 billion. That's doubled in the last 12 months alone. And that's just on reported crime. And that suggests that it's not just the people like Ross and McCliff who have got an addiction. There is an organisation behind this now. Because the rewards are so much greater, the black market is so much bigger, and the crime itself is relatively easy for people to commit. You don't have to break into a shop. You can walk in and you can walk out. It's not just about people like Ross now. It has broadened away from that as well.
Well, let's talk then about what can be done about it. The new government says it wants to change the law, which they claim effectively lets people get away with it if they steal less than £200 worth of goods. Do you think that'll make a difference?
I think it's right to take it away because that level was giving the wrong message. But we need more than that to stop the behaviour. You know, we do have people who are addicted and use shop theft as a means of funding that addiction. We need to find a way of rehabilitating those people, of finding why Ross has been able to give up drugs for 5 months and then stay clear of shop theft himself. If we can do more of that and have a properly funded program across the country, I think that would help. Neighborhood policing, every retailer I speak to says more police presence on the streets is a big deterrent. And if we can get to that point and invest in neighborhood policing as promised by the government, that too would help.
And finally, Andrew, is there more that technology can do to ban people, suspects, people with a criminal record from even getting into a shop in the first place?
Well, we're seeing record levels of investment in technology. Face recognition technology doesn't necessarily stop people getting into the shop in the first place. But what we are able to do now is identify known perpetrators based on records. And the people in the shop, the employees, are alerted to the fact that a known criminal shoplifter is in their premises. And then they can actually take action to make that person feel uncomfortable and encourage them to leave the premises, arguably. There's more investment in body cameras. There's more investment in security. The larger chains can do that. My members are smaller independent members. There is a fear, I suppose, that they could become bigger targets if the big stores become harder for the criminals to operate.
Andrew Goodacre, Chief Executive of the British Independent Retailers Association. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's 14 minutes past seven. A cancer vaccine is probably the holy grail when it comes to preventing the condition that takes so many lives here and around the world every year. And it appears to be a step closer this morning. It comes as scientists discover how the body's immune system targets the cells that have been devastated by the disease. And they believe that by using the protein from the killer cells, XPO1 it's called, they might be able to activate more killer cells to destroy the disease. To explain that and its import is Professor Pat Price, cancer expert, visiting professor at Imperial College London, also chair of Radiotherapy UK. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
I described the vaccine as the holy grail of treatment or prevention. It's fair to say that is that the main focus now, or the key focus on so much research?
Yes, it's a very exciting development because we all want cancer vaccines. Just as we know our immune system can fight viruses, if this can fight cancers, that would be so much better, targeted, less effect on normal tissue and really effective.
And this study, you think, brings us a move closer towards a vaccine?
Oh, absolutely. We know we've made great progress in other areas, but from Southampton, this is a fantastic study, worked with the Americans and the Australians. So in this one, they've looked at one of the immune system, that's the natural killer cells that really just detect and smash up viruses. They've found a protein in the cancer that it targets. And if they can smash up that, then that'll be really effective. And they've even developed in the laboratory a small bit of the protein that's in the cancer cells, so perfectly harmless. And that stimulates those killer cells. And if they could make that into a vaccine, that would be great.
I suppose a fair number of listeners will think of a vaccine as something that stops you getting a disease entirely. This, as I understand it, would not be the case with this vaccine, but it would make subsequent treatment that much less invasive. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. We know there are some viruses that cause cancer, like the HPV virus, and we now have a vaccination program for children with that, and that's great. So that will stop you getting the cancer from the virus. But this is one, once you've got the cancer and you've had that perhaps removed, but you know that sort of what's in your own cancer, then if you can make the vaccine to that, that should be able to stop it coming back, which would be brilliant.
We often have these fabulous bits of news about research. The next question is always, right, when? I mean, are we talking about a year, 5 years, 20 years? Do you know?
Well, we know we've got some cancer vaccines in trial at the moment. This one, they've done the laboratory studies, so they will have to now work it up to actually make it into a vaccine and then trial it. So this one isn't going to be available for patients for several years, but there are others. But the main thing is this is a great direction. And because we've learned such a lot about virus technology and actually vaccine technology in COVID, it means that once we know what to target, we can rapidly make these vaccines. vaccines. So this is going to accelerate this work. But this, you know, cancer is such a bad news story often. Yeah. But if we all these new ways and these better ways, it's so exciting and so encouraging for patients and for the whole public out there.
Professor Price, such a pleasure to have you on with some good news. Thank you. Now, could the AI boom that's driven record-breaking investment in global stock markets be showing some signs of slowing? Will is back with more and with the details.
Yeah, Johnny, seems a pretty extraordinary thing to say, doesn't it, about a company that made $30 billion in the 3 months to July. But there were questions from investors about Nvidia, whose microchips power much of that AI tech we're seeing being developed around the world. Ruth Fox-Blader is general partner at Fox Capital. Ruth, morning.
Good morning.
Questions about what? The staying power of AI full stop, or about Nvidia's product specifically?
Great question. So we've seen that Nvidia has really become symbolic of a number of things. It's symbolic of the AI boom and whether or not there's going to be near-term economic value for investors coming from it. And it's also symbolic of the tech sector generally, which has propped up so much of the US equities market. I think the questions that we're seeing being asked today that are resulting in a little bit of risk taking, less risk taking and selling of Nvidia stock are questions that have been asked for the past few months whenever tech companies have reported earnings about whether the outsized investment in generative AI is going to produce returns for investors soon.
Right. So that right now, so much money is going in into investment and development, whether actually the use cases are out there for that volume of investment.
Correct. And the other issue that was really impacting Nvidia was that they had revised future earnings downward a little bit, which markets never like. And in this case, there was also an issue with a production issue on the new chip. Nvidia went out of its way numerous times to say that it was a production issue with Blackwell, a new chip that they're going to be selling soon, not a design issue. But they have had to pull back a little bit and say, look, we're probably going to not make this really aggressive production schedule 100%.
Yeah, innovation and finding something new, obviously always a costly bit for a lot of those tech firms. The other thing weighing on a lot of these tech firms, and we've heard it a lot in their results, and it was mentioned in the earnings call with Nvidia today, wasn't it, is the backdrop of the US election in November and things like what a future trading relationship with China might look like. The companies like this are right in the spotlight around issues like that.
Yes, I think a few things. The US election is definitely going to impact the stock market with a lot of volatility in the run-up to the election, perhaps after the election. You know, these huge run-ups like we've seen in Nvidia stock and then pretty big sell-offs are kind of a way of the market going sideways. And that's something that happens when there's a lot of volatility and question marks. And right now we're fearing a recession. We're anticipating rate cuts. The election is going to be huge. And of course, the policy implications for whomever is elected will impact any company that has that is making hardware and has a supply chain and needs to think about where the raw materials for what it produces are coming from.
Ruth, thanks very much for your time. Ruth Fox-Blader there, general partner at Fox Capital.
Thank you very much indeed, Will. It is now 21 minutes past seven. After months of bloody stalemate, the war in Ukraine suddenly looks rather less predictable than it once did. Could Ukraine be preparing to invade and try to occupy another part of Russian territory, having taken the world in general, and Vladimir Putin in particular, by surprise in the Kursk region? And if they do that, how will Russia respond? Well, when the war began, we heard almost daily from Justin Crump, a military veteran who's chief executive and founder of Sibylline, a strategic advisory firm. Delighted to have him back with us again. Morning to you, Justin.
Good morning.
There is talk, is there not, of a second incursion by the Ukrainians. What is the evidence that it is more than just talk?
Yeah, there's certainly this these reports emerging, I should stress, mostly from the Russian side of a few hundred Ukrainian troops operating in Belgorod, attacking checkpoints there, so north of the city of Kharkiv and southeast of the current occupation site, Kursk, that Ukraine's managed to carry out. There isn't a lot more coverage of that at the moment. Again, it's coming from Russian sources. And we have seen a pattern in the past of Russian sources talking up something that happens, getting very excited about it, and then claiming a sort of glorious victory in an incident that really was, you know, fairly low-level skirmish. So that may be the case here. But I think what it certainly shows, regardless, is the level of anxiety within Russian sources and within the Russian military blogosphere. Following the Kursk operation, I think the actual shock that that did give informed people inside Russia that Ukraine could mount an operation of this size and be relatively successful. So certainly it shows the lasting legacy of Kursk is this nervousness about Russian borders elsewhere and their fear that Ukraine will emerge again somewhere else and repeat this pattern.
We've also seen misinformation from the Ukrainians themselves, haven't we? Back in the autumn of the year of the invasion, back in 2022, all the talk was that they would target Kherson, which led the Russians to redeploy their troops there. And then the Ukrainians moved on Kharkiv instead.
And of course, the people responsible for planning that are now in charge of the Ukrainian military. So you certainly see the Kursk operation in the context. You can certainly see the echoes in the Kursk operation of what we saw before in Kharkiv in particular. I mean, the Russians learned from that as well. But one of the things they did learn is complacency hurts. They've not been able to do a huge amount about that. And the Russian military still lacks agility and is concentrated itself on its offensive in the Donbass towards Pokrovsk, where it is making grinding progress in the way that works for the Russians, of really just pushing forward steadily, taking losses, but gaining ground sort of fairly remorselessly. And they continue to double down on that offensive. Ukraine's gambled by diverting its best troops away to create wider problems for Russia. So what we're really watching now is, does this strategy work, or will history in retrospect say maybe those troops would have been better used in the Donbass to just keep holding the Russians back? But for Ukraine, it's just a case of how quickly or slowly they lose ground in the Donbass versus doing something that causes real pain to Russia elsewhere.
And is it right to suggest that there are two ways it works? There's a military test that is the sort of thing that you will care about most of the time. There's also a political test, isn't there, that Zelensky wants to grab the world's attention. He wants to say, particularly to Western politicians contemplating how long this can go on, we can still make progress.
Well, I mean, I care about both, because I mean, you can't have military progress without political progress as well. There is an argument the war is the extension of diplomacy by other means, and it's certainly true here. It's not just about the battlefield movements. In fact, they can be a distraction, as you say, from the wider issues around this. And with both sides in not quite in a stalemate, but certainly in something where it's a real slogging match at this point, those wider political aspects take on a huge dimension, because that's probably what's going to make or break the outcome of the conflict, and Justin, of course, Crump, continued external support for Ukraine.
Justin Crump, thanks for joining us again.
25 minutes past seven, and it is either the end of culinary civilization or the kind of leap forward in convenience food that brought us the joy of pot noodles and microwave meals. It is spaghetti carbonara in a can, soon to be on a shelf near you with a bright yellow label, courtesy of Heinz. The reception has been mixed, to say the least, but Heinz says it will appeal to Generation Z, who presumably appreciate convenience above all things. The good news is that Harry Wallop, consumer affairs journalist, is happily even-handed in all things consumable and is here to, well, Harry, are you here to defend?
Well, no, but I think there's obviously been a lot of outrage that this is as bad as putting pineapples on pizza or mixing your Chianti with Coca-Cola. And I think we should remember that there is a very long history of spaghetti in a tin. In fact, spaghetti in a tin goes back further than carbonara itself. Carbonara is a very modern recipe. It's dated only as far back as the 1950s or 1940s, if we're pushing it. It's a modern invention, whereas Heinz has been putting pasta in a tin since 1930. That's how most Brits certainly came across spaghetti or pasta.
There is a long tradition of spaghetti in a tin, but there's not a long tradition of very nice spaghetti in a tin. I mean, let's be honest.
Yes, I mean, the ingredients of this, I have yet to try this. This goes on sale next month, so I've yet to actually enjoy the delights of carbonara in a tin.
I mean, are spaghetti hoops a regular part of your diet?
No, but I grew up with them. You know, I think we must remember...
Big spaghetti hoop fan here in the corner.
Nick, I mean, Robinson. We've got to remember that the BBC itself, back in 1957, did a Panorama April Fool's special where they claimed that they'd gone and harvested a pastor, weirdly, in Switzerland. It was voiceovered by Richard Dimbleby, no less. And lots of people fell for the April Fool because they knew nothing of spaghetti and pasta. They thought it was perfectly reasonable that it grew on a tree. So we should be, yes, very grateful about delicious carbonara with guanciale and no cream and a splash of warm water. But for many of us, spaghetti in a tin is absolutely fine.
I mean, it has to be said, it's one of the easiest dishes to make if you've got the ingredients on hand. But if you are allegedly Generation Z, that's not the point, is it? Because you're not going to have the ingredients on hand. You'll just have a tin opener instead.
Yes, in fact, I think this will be ring pulled, and that's a premium tinned product. It will take 2 minutes to cook. I mean, I'm happily going to carry on making carbonara in my kitchen.
Without cream, critically. Aaron.
Oh, absolutely. No, that would be sacrilege. I will be emulsifying my egg with the pasta water or the tears of the gods, as I believe the generation on TikTok call it.
We are a room full of pasta snobs here. Harry Wallop, thank you very much indeed. Nick Robinson, pot noodle fan, thank you. Too.
Harry, who eats garbage, so you don't have to, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. Gary is here with the sport. Gary.
Yeah, Harry's an expert on food. What part of the chicken is the nuggets?
To be continued.
Morning. Good news if you're going to the Test match at Lord's today for England against Sri Lanka. The sun is going to shine all day. Plenty of cricket, Jack, coming up, and my guest at 8:25 will be the New England captain, Ollie Pope. Among results from last night's League Cup football, League Two Wimbledon knocked out Ipswich 4-3 on penalties, but the Premier League side, we have to tell you, made 10 changes from the weekend and six players were making their debuts. Johnny, Nick and me, sounds like we could have got a game there last night. West Ham beat Bournemouth 1-0 and Newcastle knocked Nottingham Forest out on penalties after the game had finished 1-1. England have two matches next month, and after the departure of Gareth Southgate, caretaker manager Lee Carsley will name his squad for the games today, and John Murray reports.
Today marks an important first step towards Lee Carsley possibly becoming Gareth Southgate's permanent successor. It'll be intriguing to see if the Arsenal defender Ben White returns to the fold, having made himself unavailable under Southgate. But it's likely this squad will look very similar to the one that went all the way to the Euros final just 46 days ago. Jude Bellingham won't be in it, though. The Real Madrid star is injured. And Carsley has certainly had decisions to make over whether to recall big names like Jack Grealish, James Maddison and Marcus Rashford, who missed out on Germany, or whether to turn to players he knows from his role as England's under-21 coach, such as Chelsea's Nonny Madueke and Levi Colwill, Rico Lewis of Manchester City, Nottingham Forest's Morgan Gibbs-White or Morgan Rogers of Aston Villa. And West Ham's Maximilian Kilman might also have been in the thoughts of the interim coach.
Let's pop to the Belfry now, where the British Masters is about to get underway in the next couple of minutes. Good morning to correspondent Ian Carter. Ian, set the scene. Tell us who's playing.
Morning, Gary. Well, this is one of the most famous English golfing venues, the Belfry, and the tournament is the first to count in the Ryder Cup qualifying schedule. The event host, Nick Faldo, insists this is a big calling card, but it's only a $3.5 million event, relatively small when you consider the winner alone in America this weekend will be $25 million at the Tour Championship. Nevertheless, we're expecting decent crowds at the Belfry this week and a big, healthy smattering of many of the European Tour players.
Yes, you mentioned the Ryder Cup. Tyrrell Hatton is in the field, and so too is Luke Donald.
Yes, he is. Luke Donald, the captain of the Ryder Cup team. Hatton is the big talking point, though. 32 years of age, the Englishman plays on the rival LIV Tour. He's facing fines and suspensions from the DP World Tour for playing those LIV events, but he's appealing those, and that gives him the loophole to play here, helps him keep his European Tour membership, and keeps him eligible for the Ryder Cup. At 36 in the world, he's the highest ranked player in the field. He's basically exploiting a loophole. He calls it messy. We all just want golf to sort itself out for the future.
Ian Carter, thank you. At the US Tennis Open, Harriet Dart lost her second round match in New York. And after a spectacular opening ceremony, the Paralympics gets underway today. In an hour, England cricket captain Ollie Pope on his new job and how he relaxes.
I think it's important in cricket just to try and switch off, and I think that's why having a dog's really good. He doesn't care how many runs I get or if we win or lose, so that's always a positive.
Ollie Pope coming up at 8:25.
Thanks very much, Gary. It is 28 minutes to 8.
If you're looking for laughs,
this is where the magic happens.
BBC iPlayer's got you covered.
Good. Life is interesting at last.
With over 3,000 episodes of comedy favourites.
They make for great entertainers.
I need a shortlist.
Including The Office, Two Doors Down, The Thick of It, and many more.
Oh, what is that?
Whoa. Put my staper inside a jelly again.
Bring on the laughs.
What are you laughing at?
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
A quick look at the weather now. Breezy today with scattered showers moving in from the west, turning drier and brighter later on. Sunny spells elsewhere.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson. It's 28 minutes to 8, and now a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on Israel to immediately halt its large-scale military operation in the occupied West Bank. This morning, the Israeli military said its forces had killed five Palestinian fighters inside a mosque in Tulkarm on the second day of what it describes as counter-terror raids. Retailers are calling for tougher action against vendors who sell stolen goods bought from shoplifters. The British Retail Consortium has warned of a worrying trend of unscrupulous shopkeepers and market traders buying stolen items and selling them on to consumers. A BBC News investigation has uncovered examples of this type of trade. Retailers say they want more police action to tackle the problem. Ministers are considering placing restrictions on smoking outdoors in England and Wales as part of a drive to phase out tobacco. As first reported by The Sun, smoking could be banned in pub gardens and outside hospitals and sports grounds. The founder and chief executive of the messaging app Telegram, Pavel Durov, has been charged in France as part of an investigation into organised crime. The Russian-born billionaire was released on bail set at €5 million and is not allowed to leave French territory. He faces multiple charges, including failing to curb extremist and illegal content on the app. His lawyer has described the allegations as absurd. Scottish and Southern Energy has announced the completion of what's expected to be the most productive onshore wind farm in the UK. 103 turbines on the Viking wind farm and the Shetland Islands could produce enough electricity to power the equivalent of almost 500,000 homes annually. SSE have described it as a major milestone on the UK's path to clean energy system. And competition will get underway in Paris later in the first day of action at the Paralympics, with medals up for grabs in cycling, swimming, taekwondo and table tennis. At a spectacular opening ceremony last night, the head of the International Paralympic Committee, Andrew Parsons, said he wanted the event to be an inclusion revolution.
Thank you, Alan. It's 25 minutes to 8. Could Britain see a rise in the far right as has been seen in Germany and France? That is a prospect which Keir Starmer says occupies his mind. The Prime Minister was speaking to reporters in Berlin last night after his meeting with Germany's Chancellor Scholz. His centre-left Social Democrat Party is now running third in German polls, behind not just the mainstream Christian Democrats, but also the far-right AfD, which came second in June's European parliamentary election. And this political question forms the vital backdrop to the talk Starmer and Scholz had yesterday about greater cooperation, not just between Britain and Germany, but Britain and the whole of the EU. Cooperation on trade, combating illegal migration and on youth mobility. Both men, allies on the centre-left, believe that one word, delivery, is the answer to what Starmer derides as snake oil populism. Well, delighted to say we're joined in the studio again by the German ambassador to the United Kingdom, Miguel Berger. Good morning and welcome back.
Good morning.
We'll come to the substance of the talks in a second. Politics isn't what you're here to do, but it is an interesting shared interest, isn't it, between Britain and Germany, looking at what it is that fuels the right rise of parties that are not seen as being in the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely, Nick. And we have on Sunday two very important regional elections in East Germany. We are still struggling. The German society is under shock after an Islamist terrorist attack in Solingen some days ago, where a Syrian refugee killed three people and seriously wounded others. And the expectation of the German population is that criminals must find a way to bring them back, to deport them into their countries. But this is part of a wider, as you have said, discussion on delivery as the best way to combat populism.
Well, let's go through those areas that both men, both leaders want to deliver. Let's start with illegal migration. Clearly, there can be more intelligence cooperation. One thing that Britain is very concerned about, this government as well as the last one, is the fact that the boats, the inflatables that are used to cross the channel, often are stored in Germany, made in Turkey, stored in Germany, and then deployed on the coast of Belgium and of France as well. Could Germany, would Germany do more to outlaw the storage of those boats?
You know, Nick, Germany is doing a lot. We have an excellent cooperation. And whenever we get the necessary police information, we act against the criminal gangs. But yes, yesterday, Keir Starmer and Chancellor Scholz agreed to work on a migration action plan. And, you know, in my view, it's not enough to look at the channel. We have to take really the view to the broader picture. We have to work together in the countries of origin, in the countries of transit. There is a lot we can do in order to prevent migration on the way before they come to the channel. But we can enhance information sharing. So in my view, there is a lot we can do to strengthen our cooperation on migration.
We'll turn to trade in a second, but you talked of deporting foreign criminals. Now, all countries in Europe, indeed all countries in the world, share a similar problem, don't they? Which is, how do you deport to countries that don't have functioning governments, that don't protect human rights? Syria, Afghanistan, just to name two. How do you do that? Is there a way Britain and Germany can cooperate on that?
We are exploring different possibilities, especially for Afghanistan. Too early, I think, to have results. But definitely that is a topic we can discuss together.
On trade, then. There is presumably a real limit to what can be done, a limit set essentially by Keir Starmer himself, because he says not only does he want to not reverse Brexit, he doesn't want to re-explore the issue of British membership of either single market or the customs union.
Yeah, Nick, but let me really start by saying that yesterday was an excellent day for German-British relations. In the coming 6 months, we will work on a treaty that will cover the whole range of our bilateral relations. It will have security and defense at its core, but it will also deal with our business relations, with culture, with science, with sports, with all areas, and especially society-to-society contacts.
And critical to that is something you've argued for on this program as well as elsewhere, that you want young people to be able to be mobile again, to be able to move between Britain and Germany to study, to come for holidays, and also to spend a little bit of time working. Now, you know, Labour are very nervous of being seen to reintroduce a form of free movement or a youth mobility scheme. Is there a way through, in your view?
In my view, yes, there is a way through, because there are many misunderstandings about what youth mobility really means. It is not freedom of movement. It has nothing to do with migration. It means that young people, who are really those who have most lost because of Brexit, that they have the possibility to come to the European Union, to come to the United Kingdom for a limited amount of time, and then they will leave. So it's enhancing the possibilities for young people. That's what we want. And it's not only Germany. I can tell you all the 27 in the European Union want to enhance that.
That is what the EU as a whole wants. What does Britain get in return then? Because what Starmer needs to be able to show is that ordinary working class people are better off as a result of a new deal with the EU.
Yes, but you know, youth mobility should also be in the British interest. Young people from this country might want to live for a year in Berlin or in Madrid or in Paris, and the youth mobility scheme would open that possibility. What can we gain? I think we all could gain, for example, by a veterinary agreement, which would reduce prices in the supermarket.
Checks.
So
that would end those checks on live animals, yes, and food goods at the,
yes,
porters as well. So some trading possibilities. Miguel Berger, German ambassador to UK, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you.
It's 19 minutes to 8. Another quick look at the newspapers. I'm going to start with the Times newspaper and its review of the burning topic of the morning, of course, tinned spaghetti carbonara. Their food editor says the spaghetti here is tasteless mush. We all recognise some childhood tins of Alfabetti spaghetti. As for the sauce, it's hard to understand how so many components can add up to so little, and the mealy pancetta fails to lift a thin, watery, off-putting sweet travesty of a great original Italian original. A mess message to my student daughter, Antoinette Robinson, stick to the pot noodles.
A worrying sign of an obsession. And carbonara from Johnny Diamond there. Now, the front page of the Mirror reflects on those talks the Prime Minister had in Berlin and is having in Paris today, with the headline Brexit Reset. In the Mirror, PM to work with the EU on migrants and trade. The Ice has the headline Starmer must give way on youth migration, as we were hearing from the ambassador there, to get a softer Brexit, EU sources claim. The Guardian leads on an important story about the Tories ending, in quotes, woefully understating the cost of asylum. This is the think tank that we often hear from on the programme, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, saying that the Home Office got its budget figures badly wrong on Conservative asylum plans. And it is one reason, they say, that Labour are able to say that the black hole, they often talk of the budgetary black hole, was a bit of a surprise, even though plenty of us who did interviews with Keir Starmer during the election asked repeatedly about that.
On the front page of The Telegraph, we've all been let down by Genus and Edwards, says BBC chief. This is an email from the Director General of the BBC, Tim Davey, to all staff yesterday, where he told the staff that BBC would need to build trust after being let down by recent scandals. He added, "I know we have all felt let down and worried about the impact on the BBC. However, we hold ourselves to the highest standards. I know there will be lessons we can learn to ensure we have the strongest possible workplace culture." That story also on page two of the Daily Mail.
Time now, 17 minutes to eight.
The founder and boss of the messaging platform Telegram, Russian-born Pavel Durov, has been placed under formal investigation in France following his detention there on Saturday. Amongst the alleged offences, running a platform to enable illicit transactions by an organised gang and complicity in the organised criminal distribution of sexual images of children. No comment from Mr. Durov yet, but his lawyer dismissed as absurd the suggestion that he might be involved in criminal acts that don't concern him either directly or indirectly. Zoe Kleinman is our technology editor, following this one like a hawk. Zoe, we've been arguing for, 15 years about whether or not these apps and sites are publishers or platforms. The French seem to be saying he's a publisher, he's responsible for what's on the app.
Hello, Johnny. This is absolutely unprecedented for the owner of a social network to be arrested and investigated in this way. You know, we've seen people like Mark Zuckerberg and Linda Yaccarino from X hauled in front of lawmakers in the Senate in the US, but we've never seen them met by police at airports before. I think at the heart of this possibly is Telegram's refusal to comply with authorities over a lot of time. You know, we have learned that it's also refused to sign up with various programs which detect and remove child abuse images online. Things like the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Internet Watch Foundation. Now, that's not a legal requirement, but it does mean that the platform can't proactively find, remove or block images that these organisations add to their own lists. And we know that Pavel Durov in the past has been really quite robust about not engaging with authorities. You know, he left Russia in 2014 because he founded a social network there called VKontakte, which is still going and it's massive. He's sometimes described as the Mark Zuckerberg of Russia, but he refused to comply with requests for information from the authorities there as well.
People have been piling in to comment. Russia, perhaps a rather unlikely defender of free speech, says this could be seen as an act of intimidation. But I see that Elon Musk has also joined the fight.
Yeah, Elon Musk is definitely on Team Telegram, I think it's fair to say. He says he sees this as a big attack on freedom of speech. He's called for Pavel Durov to be released while he was being detained. It's worth saying he's not actually in custody now, but he's banned from leaving the country and he has to show up at a police station twice a week to make sure that he's still there. Musk says he wrote in a post on X, his own platform, that moderation is just a propaganda word for censorship. We've also seen the boss of a rather controversial video sharing platform called Rumble saying that he had fled Europe after the arrest of Pavel Durov because he's so concerned about what's going on. It's ignited this enormous debate about freedom of speech and accountability. And I think it's massively divided the community. Of course, there are others saying, you know, this is the most serious form of crime possible. And if his platform was enabling it, then he should be held responsible.
I mean, it's worth saying, and you hinted at it, a fairly large number, perhaps the majority of the social networks do sign up to sort of moderation rules and moderation bodies, which Telegram has said it will not.
That's right. But it does also say that its moderation complies with industry standards. What's different about Telegram is kind of the size of it. It's used by nearly a billion people around the world. And basically, you can have these enormous groups of up to 200,000 of them sharing and commenting on news and information. If you compare that with WhatsApp, for example, it caps the maximum number of people in a group at just over 1,000. So it is an enormous platform. And if it's not being moderated properly, then it sounds like the French authorities have a lot of questions to ask.
Zoe, thanks so much. Zoe Kleinman there, our technology editor.
It is now 13 minutes to 8 and time for Thought for the Day. Today with the Reverend Lucy Winkett, the rector of St James's Piccadilly, who joins us in the studio. Good morning, Lucy.
Good morning. She's sitting on a sofa facing the camera with a blank wall behind. Her whole head is covered in black cloth. I can't see her eyes or expression. I don't know her age or her shape, her style or her plans. But I can hear her voice because she's singing. In defiance of the Afghan Taliban's new vice and virtue rules published last week, some Afghan women are singing. Not out on the street, which is forbidden, but in their homes, published on social media. The voice of the unnamed woman broadcast on this programme yesterday stayed with me all day. "You have placed a stamp on my mouth," her song translates into English, even while she resists by singing for all to hear. The sound of the voice of a woman has been defined by the new rules to be a potential instrument of vice, and so women's voices must not be heard in public. Around 85% of the world's population practice a religion, and most religious practice places rules around the conduct and behaviour of women that are different from the rules governing the conduct of men. In Christianity, the varying degrees to which women are permitted to or prevented from exercising authority or speaking in public are hotly debated. The acute expression of this is the continuing debate within Christian denominations, including my own, the Church of England, over whether women can lead religious communities or preside over religious rituals, as I do. In short, whether and how women may be priests, whose role is in part to lead and speak and sing in public. In Christian theology, this sort of debate is ontological, that is, it's to do with my existence in the world, my creation as a woman, the givenness of my being by God, something I can't help, can't control, didn't choose. And as a priest, I've spent the last almost three decades singing the ancient songs of the church, all the time praying a new future into being, where true equality embedded in our ontology, our existence as women, finds expression in the way society and church are formed, our laws, expectations, cultural norms, and religious disciplines. My life, full of privilege and choice, may be almost unrecognisable for that unnamed woman singing in the dark, singing her protest, announcing her place in the world. But she is there. She exists, and I have heard her voice. She sings for my freedom too, and so I say to her, my sister, sing.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Lucy Winkett. It's now 10 to 8.
Pub gardens, outdoor restaurants, outside hospitals and outside sports grounds. Right now, all places where smokers can head out for a cigarette, but maybe not for long. Ministers are considering tighter restrictions on smoking outdoors, part of the drive to phase out tobacco. The new tobacco and vapes bill will not just stop the sale of cigarettes to people born after a certain date, but will also stop smoking in places currently thought of as public spaces. Dr. Leila Mackay is the Director of Policy at the NHS Confederation. Kate Nichols is Chief Executive of UK Hospitality. Welcome to you both. Good morning. Dr. Mackay, can I start with you and get a quick reaction to the news?
Well, as
somebody who works in health, I'm obviously in favour of measures that help abolish smoking. We have seen from the previous government and from this current government, and indeed from wider society, this strong commitment to move towards abolishing smoking. It is absolutely the health challenge of our time. It's the leading cause of preventable illness in the UK. So we are heartened to see that progress is being made and that the intention is moving forward to really address one of Britain's main drivers of health inequalities.
Kate Nicholls, would you like to respond?
I think we are seeing progress towards a smoke-free future, and we can see steps that are being taken since the introduction of the smoking ban in inside places in 2007. We have seen rates of smoking reduce significantly down to just 12%. There's a lot more that can be done. I'm not sure at this point in time what the proposals are for banning smoking in public places and outdoors, but it would seem sensible for us to be able to look at that more carefully and think about that in due course after we've taken some of these other steps that could be looked at. This is not without economic harm, and it's not without economic cost to businesses that are providing outside areas for smokers and non-smokers, and also vapers, because I note in some of the reports there's suggestions that vaping in outside areas could also be restricted. So this needs to be thought through very carefully before we damage businesses and economic growth and jobs.
Your members, some of your members anyway, have spent an awful lot of money creating places outside and pub gardens and the like that are comfortable for smokers to be in, where they can enjoy a drink and a smoke. Presumably they will be saying to you, you are joking.
That's very true. We've invested heavily in outside areas, not just for smokers, but also for non-smokers, to provide provision. Since the pandemic, there's been a real big investment in outside seating for people who want to eat outside. So this is not just pub beer gardens where people might be drinking. This is also outside areas in coffee shops, cafes, restaurants across our high streets, where there's been significant investment for people to be able to sit outside. The number of people who are smoking is declining, but people do enjoy those outside areas where they're vaping, and people who want to socialise with family and friends where there may be smokers involved will also have the ability to use that. So this would be a significant hit. In the decade since the smoking ban was introduced in indoor areas, we saw the loss of 10% of our pubs and nightclubs, so around 7,000 businesses closed. And this would be a significant impact, again, not just on pubs and nightclubs, but also on those wider eating out areas that we've got and that we enjoy so much and that have invested in our high streets.
Dr. McKay, sorry, I McKay'd you earlier. Forgive
it's
me.
It's McKay is the correct
McKay, right? I am sorry about that. You'll be aware, when the first ban was brought in, it was brought in not to save smokers from themselves, but it was to save those who didn't smoke from the impact of secondary smoking, of sucking in the smoke that other people produced. This would be rather different if you say it's about the outdoors. This would be saying to smokers, tough luck, we are basically legislating against your right to smoke. Do you think that is a different step?
Well, ultimately, all of these steps are steps in the same journey, which is towards a smoke-free future for Britain, reducing those health inequalities, reducing the huge problems that are caused to the individual and to society from smoking. So it's not surprising that in this journey, there will be different types of decisions and there will be hard decisions that need to be made. But I think that as a society, we do recognise that this is the right direction of travel. That has been very clear for many years since the Cannes review and before that. So I think that while we do recognise there will be all sorts of different decisions that will be part of this smoke-free future, and those will have to be carefully thought through, but it is heartening to see that that the leaders are not shying away from really thinking about what is the reality of what would have to be done to make this real and to bring in a healthier future for the next generation.
I don't want to get red-faced and start sputtering about thin end of the wedge, but I mean, a lot of doctors will tell you about the damage that alcohol does, and yet there is precious little, apart from an age bar and, I guess, tax, in the way of restricting alcohol use. Would you like to see that?
Well, honestly, I'm really interested in everything that can be done to prevent ill health. But clearly, there's all sorts of discussions and considerations to be done in all of those things. There, you know, there's alcohol, as you say. There's obesity. There's all sorts of important things that that affect the health of this country. Mm. And what we really want to see is a healthier future. So certainly, people are thinking about all sorts of ways to do that. And at the moment, really, due to the huge difference and the huge impact that smoking causes, smoking is being prioritised. And that is right, because the research tells us that addressing smoking will save thousands and thousands of lives and really reduce health inequality. So that is a really good focus at this moment.
We will leave it there. Dr. Leila McKay, Kate Nichols, thank you very much indeed.
It won't stop there, though, will it? It's quite a debate that's going to be going on, I suspect, for the days and weeks to come. Let's go over to Matt Taylor for the weather forecast there.
Thank you very much, Nick. Good morning. Hit 30 degrees in Cambridgeshire yesterday. Probably won't see those temperatures again for a while, and certainly feeling fresher out there this morning compared with this time yesterday. Across Scotland, we've got lots of cloud. Grey start today. Best of sunshine in the Northern Isles. Some outbreaks of moderate rain in the west moving in at the moment. The cloud will break up. We'll see some sunny spells develop as we go through the day. Still a few showers around, but a lot of dry weather too. But we'll get quite windy, especially across the north as we go through this morning and into early afternoon. Northern Ireland, lovely bright start. A few shower clouds will pop up through the day, but still some dry and reasonably sunny weather to be had at times throughout the day. For the Isle of Man, northwest England and Wales, lots of cloud around at the moment. Some outbreaks of rain or drizzle. Again, skies will brighten. We'll see more sunshine develop, certainly into the afternoon. Just a chance still of one or two continuing showers. For southwest England and northeast England, after a sunny start, cloud is about to increase now. Could bring the odd light shower around, but many places will stay dry, and again much more sunshine during the second half of the day. But for the Midlands, East Anglia, Southeast England and the Channel Islands, fine day ahead. Lots of sunshine this morning, even if it's fresher than yesterday. A bit more cloud into the afternoon, but still some sunny spells. Temperatures peaking around 20 to 24 degrees. Northern and western areas around 16 to 18.
Thanks, Matt. John Wilson's getting ready to meet more leading artists and creatives.
This Cultural Life, where my guests share their most significant cultural influences and experiences.
And I said, what would you like to do? You can either take a secretarial course or you can sing. I said, the easiest option is I'll sing.
In the new series, the opera singer Dame Kiri Takanawa, the crime novelist Lee Child.
We grew up with a respect for books, which was the main value in my upbringing.
And we'll also hear from the Booker Prize-winning author Marlon James.
As a child, I read everything. I thought books were keeping secrets from me, and I just wanted to know what they were.
This Cultural Life with me, John Wilson, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starts this morning at 11.
Coming up after the news, the extraordinary story of a man who shoplifts to order to supply other shops. What can be done to stop the growth in shoplifting? And we'll hear from Kevin Sinfield, who's joining us at 8:20 as he launches a new book written with his late friend and rugby league teammate Rob Burrow.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Johnny Diamond. It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 29th of August. The headlines this morning: the head of the UN has called for an immediate halt to a major Israeli military operation in the occupied West Bank, which has been continuing for a second day. Retailers have called for more police action to stop dishonest traders buying shoplifted goods in order to sell them on. Ministers are considering extending the ban on smoking in indoor public places to outdoor settings such as pub gardens. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on Israel to halt its military operation in the north of the occupied West Bank immediately. Palestinian health officials say 11 people have been killed by Israeli forces since yesterday. This morning, Israel's military announced details of an incident in Tulkarm, saying its troops had killed five Palestinian fighters inside a mosque on the second day of the operation. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell.
With the war in Gaza still raging, Israel's biggest operation in the West Bank in some 20 years is causing international alarm. These dangerous developments are fueling an already explosive situation, the head of the UN said. The EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, warned against a war extension from Gaza. Palestinians say there have been casualties and damage to homes and infrastructure in Jenin, Tulkarm, Nablus and Tubas. The Israeli military says it's carrying out a counter-terrorism operation and that it's made arrests and seized weapons. This morning it said it had killed five members of Palestinian armed groups in Tulkarm, including their local leader, who'd been hiding in a mosque.
Retailers have warned of what they call a worrying new trend of dishonest shopkeepers and market traders buying stolen items from shoplifters and selling them on to consumers. One former shoplifter has told the BBC he would steal everyday items to order. The chief executive of the British Independent Retailers Association, Andrew Goodacre, said it was depressing to hear some shopkeepers would knowingly buy such goods. He told us that in general, the high street was suffering from a rise in shoplifting and more needed to be done.
Neighbourhood police in every retailer I speak to says more police presence on the streets is a big deterrent. And if we can get to that point and invest in neighbourhood policing, as promised by the government, that too would help.
The National Police Chiefs Council said it was almost impossible to trace most shoplifted goods, but it was focused on finding those involved. Ministers are considering placing tighter restrictions on smoking outdoors in England and Wales as part of a drive to phase out tobacco. As first reported by The Sun, smoking could be banned in pub gardens and outside hospitals and sports grounds. Our political correspondent David Cornock reports.
Rishi Sunak's Conservative government tried to outlaw the sale of cigarettes to anyone born after January 2009, but its bill failed when the election was called. Keir Starmer's administration promised something similar in the King's speech at last month's state opening of Parliament, and it now appears its tobacco and vapes bill will go much further, extending the existing ban on smoking in indoor public places to areas such as pub gardens, outdoor restaurants and sports grounds. The details of any ban are likely to be subject to consultation. The Department of Health and Social Care said it didn't comment on leaks, but it said it was determined to protect children and non-smokers from the harms of secondhand smoking, and it was considering a range of measures to finally make Britain smoke-free.
The founder and chief executive of Telegram, Pavel Durov, has been placed under formal investigation in France as part of a probe into allegations of organised crime on the messaging app. The Russian-born billionaire, who was arrested outside Paris on Saturday, has been granted bail on the condition he remains in France and reports to police twice a week. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Pavel Durov is sometimes described as the Mark Zuckerberg of Russia. He was born there, but he left the country in 2014 and is now a citizen of both France and Dubai. The Telegram messaging platform he founded is currently used by nearly 1 billion people worldwide. The accusations Mr. Durov faces are very serious. They include running a platform to enable illicit transactions by an organised gang, refusing to communicate with authorities, and complicity in the organised criminal distribution of sexual images of children. His lawyer said it was absurd to suggest that he could be implicated in any crime committed on the app. It's unprecedented for the owner of a social media platform to be arrested in this way, and Mr. Durov's detention has fueled a fierce debate online about freedom of speech and accountability.
The Health and Safety Watchdog has said ambulance crews are wasting significant amounts of time being called out unnecessarily to prisons across England. One NHS trust told investigators it dealt with 5,000 calls from prison staff across its region last year. Our health reporter Jim Reid has more details.
This warning comes from the Health Services Safety Investigations Body, which examines patient safety concerns in England. It found almost three quarters of 999 calls from prisons do not need an ambulance response, compared to just one in eight calls from the general population. On one occasion, multiple crews, including an air ambulance, were dispatched to help what was described as an unresponsive inmate. Paramedics arrived to find the patient was simply refusing to answer questions. The watchdog found that prison staff were often afraid of being blamed for making a wrong decision if they did not call 999. It says the volume of calls is having a knock-on effect on the wider community and wants to see better communication between the prison authorities and the NHS. The government says it's essential that an ambulance is only called when there is a serious concern about the health of a prisoner.
More than 450 school and college leaders in England have called for post-16 vocational qualification reforms to be paused for at least a year. In a letter to the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, they say her plan to announce the changes by the end of December leaves them unable to tell prospective future students what courses will be on offer next year. Here's our education reporter, Christian Johnson.
The former Conservative government had said it would replace some Level 3 courses in England, like BTECs, with T-levels. But when Bridget Phillipson became the Education Secretary last month, she ordered what she called a short review of the reforms and said she'd make her final decision by December. Now, 455 school and college leaders have written to her to warn that simply too late. They say they will soon start holding open events for prospective students, but won't be able to give them any clarity on the courses they would offer. One college leader described the situation as madness, another as a bit of a mess. The letter is calling for next year's courses to remain unaffected by any changes. The Department for Education said it had taken immediate action to stop the planned defunding in July, and its review would bring certainty to the sector.
A network of wildlife charities wants beavers to be released into the wild in rivers across England and Wales. The animals became extinct in Britain 400 years ago, but have been reintroduced in recent years in fenced enclosures and through unlicensed releases. The Wildlife Trusts now want a policy change in England and Wales that would allow for official reintroductions, which already happen in Scotland. Rob Stoneman is Director of Landscape Recovery at the Wildlife Trusts. He told us beavers provide many benefits to their natural habitats.
Instead of storing water in our front room during floods, we store water safely in beaver wetlands, and they reduce water pollution in our rivers by filtering that water through the dams and ponds of these wetlands and effectively creating water treatment works. So our cuddliest mammal is our nature restorer, our flood management engineer, our water treatment supervisor, all virtually for free, and we need them back in our rivers and lakes.
Medals are up for grabs in track cycling, swimming and taekwondo at the Paralympics in Paris today. The games were officially opened last night at a spectacular ceremony in the Place de la Concorde. Like the Olympics last month, it was the first time the Paralympic opening ceremony had taken place away from the main stadium. The Met Office has released the list of names which will be used for storms over the coming year. The list, compiled by forecasters in the UK, Ireland and the Netherlands, includes names to honour figures from the Met Office's 170-year history. Adam Porter has more details.
Naming storms started in 2015, with each storm year running from September to August. For the coming year, James is included in memory of Group Captain James Stagg, the chief meteorologist for the D-Day landings. Lewis for Lewis Fry Richardson, who pioneered the use of maths and physics in forecasting. And Mavis in honour of Mavis Hines, who worked on the earliest Met Office computers. The year just ending is the first time there have been enough storms to reach the letter L. So while it's likely we'll hear about Ashley, Bert and Connell this winter, Raffi, Vivian and Wren will probably go unused.
And passengers on a round-the-world cruise have been left stranded in Northern Ireland for 3 months because of repeated delays to their journey. The Villa V Odyssey was due to set off on a 3-year voyage in May, but hasn't been able to leave Belfast due to problems with its rudders and gearbox. One passenger, a woman from the Sunshine State of Florida, said she'd never used an umbrella so much in her life.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. It is 8:10. Pile 'em high, sell 'em cheap. That was the recipe for retail success of the man who founded Tesco, Sir Jack Cohen, who started his life selling from a market stall. What he would no doubt be shocked to learn is that some shopkeepers these days get their goods cheaply by buying them from people who steal from shops down the road. Shoplifters are being sent orders on their mobile phones and boast of acting as the cheapest wholesalers in town. That is what we learned from a report this morning from our reporter Jim Connolly, who's been investigating shoplifting in Leeds. And after we hear his report, I'll be speaking to a chief constable about what can be done to halt the growth in shoplifting, now at the highest level for 20 years and still growing fast. Jim Connolly's report begins with Ross, who's been shoplifting for much of his life.
Perfume, always a staple. Box sets, cosmetics, leather handbags. A big box of Lego can be £100.
Shoplifting has rarely been out of the headlines of late, but we never hear from the criminals at the centre of it.
I know it's in the tens of thousands,
You've stolen tens of thousands of pounds.
Yeah, I'm ashamed to say, yeah. I'm not allowed in most of the shops around here.
Is that just because you stole so much over the years?
Yeah, yeah. And now I'm banned.
This is Ross. He's 39 and has been shoplifting for half his life, all to fuel his crippling addiction to crack cocaine and heroin.
It was just to buy drugs.
We've been told by experts that 70% of shoplifters are people like Ross, addicts. So you can see what's fueling the problem.
You just want to make as much money and get out of there as soon as you can.
Leeds is a mix of stunning 19th century arcades, high-end shops and quirky independent retailers. It's a shopping destination for people across the north of England, but it's also a mecca for shoplifters. The city has been given the unenviable label, the shoplifting capital of the country. Ross says until recently, he was one of its most prolific offenders.
I think I'd be a gold medalist if it was shoplifting were a sport.
There really isn't such thing as a victimless crime, though, is there? I mean, shoplifting costs the country billions of pounds. What do you think about that?
I feel guilty and ashamed. People who shoplift are ill, and that's why they're doing it.
Ross says he stole around £300 worth of goods each day to fund his drug addiction, and that means most days he wouldn't be caught. West Yorkshire Police says it's very much aware of the concerns of businesses when it comes to shoplifting, adding it regularly reviews offences to identify the patterns of offending to put robust plans in place to address them.
There was a weight of fear every day walking down the hill from where I live.
Because you thought you might get caught?
Yeah, and I was only ever inches away from it.
And you have to remember, people like Ross can only operate if someone is willing to buy stolen goods.
He's asking me for whiskey, vodka Baileys.
Ross showed me his phone, and it was full of this.
Tia Maria, honey cheese, washing tablets and liquid if you can, please, mate.
Daily requests to steal to order, all via a middleman. It seemed shocking until he told me where else he sold his stolen goods to. Other shops across the city.
I have my bag full of stuff. I'd know which shop to go to sell it on. And, they didn't want to get seen on the camera. They'd take me into the back room. I lay it out on the floor. We discuss a price. And I'm out of there with the money.
It sounds crazy to say that, doesn't it?
It's the economics, isn't it? I suppose I was the cheapest wholesaler at the end of the day.
Ross says he's been clean now for 5 months and is apologetic for his past actions. But we can't get away from the fact that people like him make everything we all buy more expensive. Figures given to us by the Centre for Retail Research suggest shoplifting adds £133 onto an average household shop each year. Those that represent shops just want more police action. Helen Dickinson is the CEO of the British Retail Consortium.
This is absolutely vital if we're to deal and to address the increasing trend that we're seeing of unscrupulous businesses taking on local product that has been stolen to order in their local communities.
I've come now to Paw Prints, a pet shop in the centre of Leeds, to meet Supervisor Freya.
Wait back in on a red light.
So we're just getting reports through of a guy who's a potential suspected shoplifter by the sound of it. And we've had another shoplifter in this shop, so you can see just how active it is. Can you describe what happened?
So we've just had someone come in and managed to steal one of our cat treats. She picks something up and then puts it back down. And then this is the product that she actually ends up stealing.
You were pretty annoyed when it had happened.
People are getting away with this sort of thing, and we kind of just have to stand there and watch it happen over and over again.
Do you think she just knows she's going to get away with it?
I think so, yeah.
What happens if one of those three had a knife?
Yeah, so that is the risk that we take with approaching them.
Does that scare you?
It does, yeah.
And that's one of the big fears I keep hearing from retailers, stepping in and facing danger. Ross insists that he never used violence.
I get sick feeling, literally, thinking about what I used to do. And yeah, all the guilt.
You say that you only targeted big chains, but the people that work in those big chains have told me they're terrified when shoplifters come in. Can you understand the fear that you put through people?
Oh, yeah. Please understand that it's just a simple case of survival, it felt like. I feel like I didn't have a choice. There's always a choice, but it doesn't feel like you've got one when you're that desperate.
There's no escaping the fact Ross is a criminal. 23 convictions in the past two decades, including 15 for shoplifting. But he's never been to prison. And for some, they'll hear that and be angry that he's never faced the most severe punishment. Others will argue a man with a 20-year crippling addiction should have been helped more, and that may have stopped his offending. Ross is just left wondering what could have been.
I'm not saying I was let down, but I needed help. I'm getting the help now. If I'd have got the help, it might have been a different life.
Jim Connolly reporting there and talking to Ross in Leeds. Now, shopkeepers often complain that police ignore calls about shoplifting, don't send officers, and even if they do, serial shoplifters, people like Ross, rarely go to prison. Let's talk now to the Chief Constable of the force that has the highest charge rate of any force in England and Wales, the Chief Constable of Norfolk, who is Paul Sanford. Good morning, Chief. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Do you recognise the picture you heard in that report from Leeds?
Sadly, I do, yes. Shoplifting is on the rise across the UK, and it's all too common that it's individuals with chronic addiction who are behind a significant proportion of this offending. So, yes, it's a tale that we are very familiar with.
It won't surprise people that it's addicts that often shoplift to feed their habits. It might surprise them that being run by middlemen who are acting as wholesalers to other shopkeepers.
I'm sure that that does occur again across the country. The amount, the extent to which it does, Nick, I'm not sure. I think certainly even since the days when I was a PC, we had shoplifters, burglars selling or trying to exchange their stolen goods in places like second-hand shops and market stalls. I don't think that's a new phenomenon. It's something that has been going on for a while. What do we need to do to respond to that? We need to make sure that there's adequate deterrent. We need to make sure that shoplifters are seeing police officers when they commit their crimes and that those crimes are being detected. And also policing does need to investigate those premises where we suspect that those items may well be stolen. We're doing that in Mine County in Norfolk with good success. But across the UK, I think it's fair to say we've still got a long way to go.
So is it the absence, in your view, of a deterrence, the absence of police officers, that explains this huge increase in shoplifting? And it is a huge increase, isn't it?
Well, as you said when you introduced me, Nick, in my force, we're detecting 46% of shoplifting. So, you know, you've roughly got a 50% chance as to whether you're going to get caught. Now, that for me is a strong deterrent. That's a strong risk-reward ratio. I think what needs to follow, though, is the appropriate sanction and a swift sanction. Quite often there's a lot of comment about whether it should be prison or some form of order. But for me, speed of intervention is really important, particularly when these offences are driven by drug or alcohol addiction.
And speed is a problem, is it, because of the backlog in the courts, which presumably means it can be months longer.
Too often it is. And I think that allows the offender to carry on with their behaviour without checking. So that's certainly something that I think the criminal justice system as a whole has got to work at.
So more police, you've said that, quicker justice. What about this so-called £200 rule? The new government says that the previous Conservative government had introduced a change to the law that they want to reverse, the idea that if you shoplift less than £200 worth of goods, you are treated more leniently. Now, there's some dispute about whether that's a fair summary of what happens. What's your experience?
Yeah, that doesn't happen in my police force, and I don't think it happens in many police forces up and down the country. We recognise that if someone steals something to the value of £190 and does that across five stores, they make quite a bit of profit during a day. And that £190 could be the profit, the single profit for a small store. So, no, we take action about that.
Forgive me interrupting, you've got to show that there are multiple small offences, haven't you? And the shoplifters tell our reporters that they know exactly about this £200 rule and they shoplift to stay below it.
No, Nick, we investigate that. If needs be, we prosecute that. Our outcome rates show that we do so as well. And critically, on top of that, we take a real focus on offenders, looking at not just their behaviour with the crime that's in front of us, but their recent offending across the months previous, so that when we do take a case to court, it's with a full understanding of that offender's behaviour, which means that they get a stronger sanction. Mm. And pleasingly, why I think we're having success in my county is because we're taking that offender focus and putting the strongest possible cases in front of court and then following those cases up with criminal behaviour orders. So we're banning these shoplifters from the high streets from when they're stealing. It's proving to be really effective. £200 or not has no say in our action.
Interesting. Now, Look, there is much focus on this politically in the news as well. There was a retail crime action plan produced by the last government at the beginning of the year. And yet, figures produced by the co-op suggest, yes, there's been an improvement in police turnout, but there's still 2 in 5 incidents where nobody comes.
Policing is attending more incidents than we have before. I was speaking to a group of my officers just 2 weeks ago, where they had reported to them a shoplifting that had been on CCTV. It had occurred 2 weeks prior. The shop emailed in the CCTV. We washed the pictures from that CCTV across our facial recognition database, and we arrested the offender the following day. We didn't need to visit the premise. There was no need to visit the premise, but we delivered justice. So sometimes attendance isn't necessary, but when it is, we will be there.
I want to be clear, Mr. Sanford. It appears to me you're saying that if the police focus on this, and if the government are able to produce a criminal justice system that can deal quickly with it, you think this can not just be stopped, the rise in shoplifting, but potentially reversed, do you?
Well, we've proven in my county that you can catch offenders in significant quantities when it comes to this sort of crime. What you need, though, is sufficient police officers on our streets. I would agree with the comments that were made earlier about that. We need swift and relevant sanction, and we need to address the underlying causes, namely drug and alcohol addiction. If you do all of that, I think we've got a chance of addressing this offending.
Paul Sanford, Chief Constable of Norfolk, thank you for joining us.
It's 22 minutes past 8. Of all the images of friendship in adversity, one sticks out for many people. It is that of Kevin Sinfield carrying his friend and former teammate at the Leeds Rhinos, Rob Burrow, over the finishing line at the Leeds Marathon that was named after Rob. Rob suffered from motor neurone disease and died in June. But before he left us, he worked with Kevin on a children's picture book called Try, that comes out today. Kevin's in our Salford studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a couple of months on from Rob's death. I have to ask, I mean, how are you?
Yeah, I'm okay, thank you. I think it'd be pretty clear to everybody when you lose somebody as special as Rob was, you miss them dearly, so there's a void for all of us, but you get on with life and you don't forget.
You are bringing out this children's book. I think it's out today. What is it that you want young readers to take from the book?
Well, I think we really enjoyed doing it together. I suppose it's the final thing we have ever completed together, so I'm very proud of it. It was something that we developed an idea around friendship, and we wanted to help young children to understand how important friendships are. We wanted to understand, especially with young boys, to understand that being a good friend is really, really important. And the story follows two little boys, Rob and Kevin, throughout school, who are exploring what heroes are. And they find out very, very quickly that they are each other's heroes from just doing daily things and caring for each other.
You say especially boys. Why boys? Do you think they need the message a bit more?
Oh, no, I think it's important for girls as well, but I think, you know, I've got two boys myself, Robert, a little boy, Jackson, so we understand just how important male role models are for young children, but especially young boys. I think the more we can help them and shape them and encourage them to be better friends, I think it makes it a bit better for everybody.
Can you tell me what it was like writing the book with Rob?
Yeah, it was good fun. It was really good fun. We worked with Ben, who was an incredible illustrator, and Emma, who wrote the book alongside us. And there was a lot of to and fro and a lot of laughter. But when the finished book came through and I saw it for the first time, you know, I welled up. And I know as you get older, you become a bit more emotional. But I was just really proud of what we produced, and the fact that we're able to get a message out there around friendship is really important to both of us, and something that, you know, we'd have both loved reading to our young boys ourselves and our young children. So, yeah, we're really proud of it.
I mean, it's a product of your very long friendship. I wonder, over the last couple of months, as you've been thinking about Rob, whether you've thought about him, whether you remember him as the rugby player, as what some people would call sort of able-bodied, or as the man that you enjoyed life with, cared for and loved with motor neurone disease?
I think it's both. I think it's important we remember Rob as a rugby player because he was unbelievable, superhuman in many ways. And then the guy off the field who was later diagnosed with MND just became such a courageous, brave individual. And I think he inspired so many people, including myself, across the UK. He's been a beacon of hope for the MND community and he's left a massive hole now. So it's important we never forget. It's important there is a legacy in place. And like I said, I think the book and being able to do this together and it'd be the final thing we've been able to complete together, to know that we've produced something that could be impactful across young children across the UK is pretty special, and I know that everybody in the Borough household this morning will be incredibly proud and happy with what's been produced.
Kevin, thanks so much for coming on and talking about your book and, of course, your friend Rob.
Thank you very much.
27 minutes past 8. More sport. Gary.
Good morning. The second test between England and Sri Lanka gets underway in a couple of hours. And good news if you're going to Lord's, it's going to be sunny all day. Well, England won the first test at Old Trafford and I've been chatting with the captain, Ollie Pope, about his new role.
It was different. I won't say it wasn't different. The first, I guess, day or so took it out of me. I guess just being constantly busy, constantly using your mind, not from a physical point, more so from a mental point and finding different ways to take your 10 wickets. So it almost, in a way, almost felt like a debut again. But I've had some good lessons from the captaincy stuff. Really enjoyed it when I was out there. And yeah, hopefully I can contribute more with the bat over the next couple of weeks to compartmentalise my batting and my captaining. But really enjoyed it.
So it was actually draining would be the right word to use.
I wouldn't say draining necessarily. I think the first day when you take on a new role, I think just by the end of it, I was ready for a good sleep and then sort of woke up pretty fresh. So I really enjoyed it. It was just getting used to sort of spending a whole day in the field and making all the decisions. And I think on a pitch where you had to find ways of getting 10 wickets. So I wouldn't say it was necessarily draining and just different to what I was used to. But no, I really enjoyed it.
There's a lot of thinking on your feet then?
A lot of thinking on my feet. Obviously, I've got some really good players to lean on within the change. Obviously Rooty, the amount he's captained, and obviously Harry Brook, the vice captain of the team, he's got a great cricket brain, in guys like Ben Duckett as well, so there's a lot of people for me to lean on, and if they think they can see something there, they'll come up to me and I'll have a think about it. So it was helpful having those guys, but a lot of thinking on your feet as well.
You have good advisors around you, but you want to be your own man, be yourself. How easy is that, Ollie?
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy. It's obviously a slightly different situation when you come in, and this isn't my test team, this is still Stokes' test team, so it kind of means that, even if I was taking over, there wouldn't be any different styles of messages. We know how we want to go play our cricket, and we know how we want to adapt in slightly different conditions because we're a team that's been together for a long while now. So I think that's a real positive for us. And yeah, no, I think obviously want to be my own man, of course, but it's just about sort of over the course of the next two tests is keep taking this team forward, and then when Stokes comes back in, then hopefully he can pick off where he left off.
And how much input did he give you, Ben Stokes?
Oh, he was good. I asked him a couple of questions more on how to get the best out of our bowlers and sort of what he thinks with sort of different spells. So I think that was probably the main thing. But he let me go and do my own thing. He wasn't sort of all over me in the changing room.
And you did do that at one point, didn't you? The changing of the field positionings, that was clear. You made decisions out there that worked.
Yeah, I think we tried a few different things with the nature of that pitch. So, and for me, it was just about making sure that we tried to keep those catches in as much as we can, because at the end of the day, like I said, you want to go and take 20 wickets in the test match.
We're here at Lord's, the long room's just over there, and later this morning you will wander through, you'll walk past the paintings of W.G. Grace, and you'll come down four or five steps and you'll be captain of England. That's quite something, isn't it? At Lord's?
Absolutely, it's a big honour. I mean, leading your country out is, I think, the biggest honour in English cricket. Obviously, to do it at the home of cricket in front of a packed house at Lord's is going to be pretty cool and something I'm really looking forward to.
And lastly, I know you have a dog. A friend of mine sees you on Clapham Common walking your lovely dog. When you're out there, are you thinking cricket and I might do this and I might do that? What thoughts are you having?
Sometimes, but I think it's important in cricket just to try and switch off. And I think that's why having a dog's really good, because it's something just to take my mind away from the game. I think obviously test cricket's the longest format of the game, where you spend 7 or 8 days on the spin getting ready for a test. So I think when you do get a day off, you've got to try and find a way to occupy the mind.
And no matter whether you play well or not, to your dog, you're a hero, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And that's always a nice thing to have. And he doesn't care how many runs I get or if we win or lose. So that's always a positive.
Lovely to chat to you, Ollie. Thanks.
Cheers. Thank you.
Test match special starts at 10:25. Coverage of the US Tennis Open will take over on Sports Extra from 7 o'clock this evening, and Britain's Harriet Dart was knocked out in the second round. The first of 11 days of competition at the Paralympics is underway in Paris, with 549 gold medals on offer in the coming days.
Thanks, Gary. We'll have some chat about those Paralympics coming up. It is 29 minutes to 9. First, let's look ahead to one of this weekend's highlights.
Drama on BBC Radio 4.
Nothing today is as straightforward as it seems.
A 21st century take on an Indian classic.
If you were a god, how would you manifest in the modern world?
When asked the right questions, the right answers will be served.
The epic Mahabharata now continues as family rifts mean difficult choices.
We're going to make them pay for what they've done.
But is it really a choice if it's offered by a god?
You have thought enough. Time now for action.
Mahabharata Now, on Sunday afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Quick look at the weather. Breezy today with scattered showers moving in from the west, turning drier and brighter later on. Sunny spells elsewhere.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Johnny Diamond. It's 28 minutes to 9. Let's get a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
The UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has called for an immediate end to a major operation by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. This morning, the Israeli military said its forces had killed 5 Palestinian fighters inside a mosque in Tulkarm on the second day of what it describes as counter-terror raids. Retailers have warned of what they call a worrying new trend of dishonest shopkeepers and market traders buying stolen items from shoplifters and selling them on to consumers. The Chief Constable of Norfolk Police, Paul Sanford, told us more high-profile policing and swifter justice were needed to tackle the problem. Tighter restrictions on smoking outdoors are being considered by ministers as part of a drive to phase out tobacco. As first reported by The Sun, smoking could be banned in pub gardens, outside hospitals and sports grounds. And a lawyer for the Telegram founder Pavel Durov has described a decision by a French judge to put the billionaire under formal investigation as totally absurd. Mr. Durov is accused of failing to curb illegal content on the messaging service.
Thanks, Alan. He is the leader of Britain's third biggest party in Parliament, and he is on the warpath. Well, not the warpath, but he has the light of battle in his eyes. Sir Ed Davey, leader of the Liberal Democrats, wants to push back the government's decision to curtail winter fuel payments to the poorest pensioners. That decision taken by the Chancellor Rachel Reeves after she said she'd found a £22 billion black hole in the nation's finances. And that decision is thought to be a saving of £1.5 billion a year. Sir Ed Davey, leader of the Liberal Democrats, joins us now. Good morning, Sir Ed.
Good morning, Johnny.
Can I start with a statement by Citizens Advice that it made in July 2024? It said, the current winter fuel payment is not well targeted and is too low to make a real difference to pensioners who need help most. We need to see targeted support with energy bills for all those in desperate need, including low-income families and pensioners. It appears they do not agree with you.
Well, I think they and many other organisations are very worried about the government's move as we see energy bills going up. The Ofgem just announced the cap on energy bills going up by 10%, over 10% this winter. And with the withdrawal of the former support that pensioners had last year, with the now the withdrawal of the winter fuel allowance for millions of pensioners, it's going to leave some pensioners less than £670 worse off this winter. That's a huge hit.
That will be. That will also be the some very well-off pensioners. The point they make is it is not well targeted, a universal benefit that benefits people who are millionaires.
Well, there are a number of ways the system currently withdraws benefits from very wealthy people. We could look at that. But let's be clear what's happening with this decision by the government. There are going to be millions of pensioners who are really vulnerable and poor, people who are eligible for pension credit but don't get it. There's nearly a million of those. Then there's several million pensioners who aren't eligible for pension credit but are really struggling. And some of the organisations like Citizens Advice and others have worried very much about those. And we share those worries. And the government has not put forward anything to help those people. And that's why I think they need to think again, and why Liberal Democrat MPs, all of us, have signed what's called a prayer to try to trigger a vote and a debate in Parliament to get the government to think again.
You say think again. Does that mean rolling back in its entirety the decision? Or would you simply like the cap to be raised, if you will, and a few more of the poorer pensioners included with the winter fuel payment?
John, it's not a few more. We're talking about millions. With energy prices going up again.
But do you accept the principle of means testing? Forgive me. Do you accept that the richest pensioners simply do not need this payment?
Well, as I said to you earlier, there's a whole set of ways in the system where we withdraw benefits from people who don't need them. So, for example, the child benefit, as you know, there's a cap on that. So we can have a debate about that. But I think this is really, really key. The government's proposals will leave millions of pensioners, not just a few, millions of pensioners who are really struggling without some support this winter. And, you know, we do need a comprehensive approach. That's what Liberal Democrats are arguing for. For example, where is the energy insulation programs to help pensioners? You know, if you really want to reduce the need for winter fuel allowance, and other things, you need to sort out Britain's drafty homes. You need a massive program so people can afford energy bills because their homes are well insulated. So that sort of approach is what is needed. And I think the government have I think it's their first big mistake, if I'm honest with you, Johnny.
What about other groups who are in need? I mean, in particular, those who have prepayment meters or for private renters. You're not speaking to them at all.
Well, I'm responding to the government's proposal on winter fuel allowance, which we're against. But you're right to raise other groups. I think the warm home discount is the way to go for many others. For those of you who aren't familiar with that, that is a targeted approach. It enables people who are on low incomes in receipts of various benefits to get money directly off their energy bill. It's a really good targeted system. And I absolutely want to see the warm home discount expanded and be more generous. That is the way to help not just vulnerable pensioners, but actually people across the piece.
Sir Ed Davey, we will leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. Sir Ed Davey, leader of the Liberal Democrats.
It is now 22 minutes to nine.
The rather refined world of classical music might be one of the last places you'd expect to find sexual harassment. But today, the Equality and Human Rights Commission publishes advice to orchestra managers to try and prevent sexual harassment in the industry. The Independent Society of Musicians has welcomed the guidance. It talks of a culture of fear which has ruined the lives of far too many musicians. It says a third of its members who responded to a survey have experienced an incident of sexual harassment. A few moments ago, I spoke to John Kirkpatrick, Chief Executive of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, and to Rebecca Towell, a musician who says this sort of guidance might have prevented her from being sexually assaulted whilst at work. I started by asking Rebecca why people are wrong to assume sexual assault does not happen in the classical music industry.
I think people have a misconception about the classical music industry that perhaps because we play classical music that is often seen as quite picturesque and bucolic, maybe, that you know, bad things don't happen in the industry and that we're doing something that we love and everything must be kind of jolly and having a good time. But actually, there's, you know, a darker side to the industry because of the work being so precarious and the industry is not really in a good shape at the moment. It just creates this culture of silence that people can't speak out and that people do end up getting away with things that they absolutely shouldn't.
And there are hierarchies in the music industry, like there are hierarchies in nearly every work sphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you have even within the orchestra, within your section of players, so I play the trumpet, and in the section you have first trumpet, second trumpet, third trumpet, maybe,
yeah.
And the first trumpet is your mini boss.
Right.
And then maybe if you're in the brass section, then the first trumpet is the leader of the brass section sometimes, and then in the orchestra, the conductor's the kind of hierarchy of the of that, and then you have the fixer, and there's all these levels that kind of create this larger hierarchy. And even when you're studying, you have your teacher who might then go on to give you some work, so you need to impress them. Yeah. And there's lots of power structures that are kind of unspoken.
John, can you tell me why you felt it was so important to release this guidance?
Well, I suppose two reasons, really. The starting position, everybody should feel safe at work.
Yeah.
But it's very clear from the research conducted by the Independent Society of Musicians that there's been a big problem in classical music industry, in orchestras, and arguably across the wider music industry. And partly, I suspect, because of the very characteristics of the industry that that Rebecca's talked about, that there are these power structures, there are these people in very vulnerable situations. And we felt it's really important that people with power and with management responsibilities in these circumstances, you know, behave properly. They put the right procedures and processes in place. They manage as they should in order to make these safe workplaces.
Now, Rebecca, I mean, that the survey from the Independent Society of Musicians, it has a rather shocking top line. Is there much discussion of this amongst musicians? Is there much discussion about sexual harassment, sexual assault?
If I spoke to any of my female colleagues or non-male colleagues, none of them would be surprised by this. Whenever I do talk about it, there are flocks of stories from every non-male musician I know, generally,
yeah.
And obviously some male, that everybody has or knows somebody that has had an experience. You do generally get perhaps male members of the orchestra that are surprised when they hear about these statistics. But there is still an imbalance, particularly in the areas that I work in, the brass, in terms of gender imbalance. So actually, there are more male musicians. So in the context in which we work, those conversations are not happening.
John, can I ask you at whom the guidance is aimed in particular? I mean, is it what you might call the boss class, or is it about the broader numbers of musicians who may be affected?
Well, it's principally at those with management responsibilities, because right. It's their responsibility to put the right structures and processes in place. We think that anybody across the orchestral sector, or indeed the wider music industry, could benefit from looking at what we recommend and suggest, and actually putting the house in order. I think that would be of benefit. I mean, it's one of the things that we say in the guidance is it's really important to make sure that you've got proper reporting mechanisms without adverse consequences.
And Rebecca, as far as you're aware, or you and your colleagues are concerned, are those reporting mechanisms around?
In my entire career, I've only been made aware of one workplace to report something. The whole other situations I've been a part of, I've never heard or been made aware of any place to report anything like that.
And John, do you want essentially the reporting mechanisms to be publicised, to be open and out there, and then I guess sunlight to flood in?
Well, they need to be visible and available to the people who need them, to the people who actually have something to report, and it needs to be clear that there are no kind of adverse consequences coming from that. Oh, and if I can go slightly more widely just for a moment, the law is changing on sexual harassment at work. We've just, in addition to this toolkit and this guidance, we've just consulted on guidance on the new duty on employers to anticipate or to take steps to prevent sexual harassment at work.
Rebecca, do you feel sort of cheered by the guidelines that are being issued? Do you think it is going down the right path at any rate?
I mean, you can get not asked back for not socialising the right way, for not going to the pub after a rehearsal or a concert, or for not getting the teas in the lunch break, you know. So actually, when it comes to something like reporting sexual harassment, it feels like you're making a big fuss, and that's going to really negatively impact your chances of getting asked back. So to have these reporting mechanisms visible and in place gives you a sense of support that has been lacking up until now.
Rebecca Toll, John Kirkpatrick, thank you very much for coming in this morning.
is now 8:45. Again and again, you'll hear Keir Starmer and his ministers blame the Conservatives for leaving what they call an economic black hole, which they claim to have discovered in the public finances since taking office. Well, this week, the Prime Minister used his first big speech not just to repeat that claim, but to mention another black hole he said had been left by his predecessors, what he called a societal black hole. And last night, speaking to reporters in Berlin, he said the possibility of Britain seeing a rise in the far right, as has been seen in Germany and in France, was something that, in his words, occupied his mind. Well, on this week's episode of the Today podcast, Amal and I have been in conversation with Claire Rainsley, the author of the book The New Working Class, How to Win Hearts, Minds and Votes, which led Keir Starmer to hire her as Director of Policy, a job she did until a couple of years ago. We asked her what Starmer meant by a societal black hole.
I thought when Starmer talked about this societal black hole, I thought that was one of the most interesting parts of this speech. And I don't think it's been fully articulated yet, but I think he was getting at something that many people have seen, felt, referred to. And it talks to this sense that our societal bonds are less strong, and it not be a nostalgic look back at somehow what community used to mean, but it'd be a much more forward-looking, modern articulation of what Britain could be. And I think that that existed well before the riots. I think it's actually part of why people voted to leave the European Union in the first place. And nobody's really quite articulated that into a political vision as yet. But I thought Starmer was starting to lay some of the bones of that down in this speech this week.
Does Keir Starmer have the economic answers?
So I think there are two things. I think there is the first is the kind of, the, as you say, what's the economic programme? And I think it has to be a really ambitious economic programme to, you know, reset how our economy works. And I think that Starmer has put much of that into his programme. I do think that better employment rights for people are at the core of it. But I also think more economic opportunities across the country. So not just redistribution from south to north, crudely, but everybody feeling like within their vicinity, they have the chance to progress. But the second aspect to it, and I would like to see more on this, is how we go about actively remaking those societal bonds. And I think that that cannot just happen organically. I think that this pandemic showed that people want to come together as communities, but there's been very little state support to do that. If anything, the state has kind of walked away over the past 10 years of austerity from some of those community arrangements that I think people thrived on.
Can you give an example? What sort of thing?
Well, I would like to see there being much more investment in kind of community organisations, mutual and peer support for people. I would like to see that spirit that we had during the pandemic. Do you remember when people were volunteering for the NHS? Why can't we make that into a national programme to tackle some of the loneliness for our older people?
Do you worry that that's another black hole alongside the budget black hole he speaks of and the societal black hole? So far, at least, there's a bit of a vision black hole, a positive vision black hole.
I think he's got it. I just think that I think we heard it during the election campaign. It's just that, you know, if you're taking a country through significant change, which is what he got a mandate to do, it's what that manifesto said. It was all about change. People don't want to experience change in every aspect of their life. They want to know that the change the country is going on, that they are themselves having to play a part in, is taking them to a destination that is going to mean that they are better off or that their next generation are better off. So I just would like to see more of that vision dialed up in all of the speeches, even the ones that are kind of levelling with us about the state of the public finances. Otherwise, I think it's quite hard to keep people with you on this difficult journey.
How do you keep people on that difficult journey? Well, let's reflect on that with the former Conservative Minister, Lord Willetts, David Willetts, who wrote a book a long time ago now, David, The Pinch, saying that governments, whatever their politics, should take some money away from wealthier, older people and give it to their children and their grandchildren. It looks as if that's what Keir Starmer is trying to do, but he's finding the politics pretty difficult, isn't he?
Yes, and I thought it's very interesting what Claire was saying, and I agree with a lot of it. We do want to see stronger social bonds, and often the most powerful and appealing are between the generations. And there are a lot of older people who themselves are now worried that their children and grandchildren aren't going to have as good a prospect as they had, aren't going to see the same increases in living standards. And look, we've just brought out today at Resolution Foundation a new set of figures showing in the last 30 years, pensioner incomes have doubled, have gone up by more than 100%, and family incomes have gone up by about 50%. I'm sure there are many pensioners who want to see a world where their children and grandchildren are going to be better off than they were, not whose incomes are lagging behind.
But then how do you deal with the politics? You had many years in opposition trying to make arguments, and it's not easy to do in opposition. It's harder still, perhaps, in government. Simple arguments being put at Keir Starmer at the moment. Ah, right, you're giving money to your mates, public sector workers, and you're doing it by robbing pensioners. That's the claim that's being made. How do you get round that if you want to make the sort of changes you've long argued for?
Well, I mean, I think on the winter fuel payment, where actually I think they're right that it's no longer the case that pensioners are more likely to be poor than any other age group. So trying to focus benefits like that on pensioners isn't well targeted. What the common cause is, there is a problem of fuel poverty. There are people of varying ages who are struggling to meet high energy bills. And again, it's an example of society coming together. We should all want, perhaps through social tariffs, discounted energy bills for low-income families to help you, whatever your age, break free from the idea it has to be done by age. I think that's an appeal that even many older people would understand. And I also find, and there's some polling support for this, there's increasing number of older people who are worried about the world their children and grandchildren are going to inherit, and appeal to that concern they've got.
So in summary, David, are you saying you have to have an appeal, you have to have an approach that convinces the older of us that it's in their own interests, it's in society's interest to change the balance a little?
It's both. What kind of world do you want your children or grandchildren to be in? So this is an appeal to their care for their children and grandchildren. And I also found, and look, when I did face the electorate as a constituency MP, and of course every MP faces this, older people who don't want housing developments near their estate or whatever, also say, look at what society has done for you in the past. The reason why you've got this house is in the 1960s and 1970s, lots of houses were being built for you when you were starting your family. All we've got to do is to do for the next generation what the previous generation did for you.
David Willetts, Lord Willetts of Now, of the Resolution Foundation, that book, The Pinch. Thank you very much indeed. You want to hear a lot more of our conversation with Claire Ainslie? Place for relaxed conversations about big public questions is the Today podcast. Comes out once a week on a Thursday morning. BBC Sounds is the place to go.
It is 7 minutes to nine.
And we are not turning to what we were doing earlier, but we are turning, Johnny, to the Paralympics.
Oh, we are. I'm so sorry. I thought we were going elsewhere, but we're not. 4,400 athletes from 168 delegations competing for 549 gold medals. If anyone thought the Paralympics lived in the shadow of the so-called main event, the launch last night of the Games in Paris showed them they might be very wrong. A Paralympic revolution is how the president of the Paris 2024 organising committee described events last night. You have no limits, he said, so let us stop imposing limits on you. Well, one woman who knows no limits is Ellie Simmons, 8-time Paralympic swimmer, now part of Channel 4's presenting team. Good morning, Ellie.
Good morning. Yeah, what a wonderful opening ceremony it was. I think for me, this is my first time from the other side, and seeing it makes you want to race, because I'm like, oh, I've done that now, you know. But I think just to be, it makes you so proud to be part of the Paralympics and be a Paralympian.
Can I tackle you on what something that the cynics would say, that this is still in the shadow of the main games, the games that came earlier this month? Are they right?
I think the Paralympics is one of the biggest sporting events in the world. And I think with the coverage that we had last night, we saw in the sporting world how big it actually is. And yes, I think the coverage could be better in the world, like Channel 4, what they're doing to showcase Paralympic sport is the next level. It's been incredible from the likes of 2012 to now. But I think the world is moving on, and showcasing Paralympic sport in the world and also talking about disability. And I think we saw that yesterday with the likes of the president and Andrew Parsons talking about how important it is to talk about disability in society and how talking about it and making sure, yes, we have Paralympians and we have Paralympic sport, but it's about making sure the billion of people with a disability are living in a world where they're accepted and the world is a place for them.
And you think the games have a role to play, a much wider one than simply sport, when it comes to people with disabilities?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think also it's raising awareness of what Paralympians and people with a disability can do. And also I think that education and awareness, and I think we see it, don't we, in the media, how representation and seeing the people like yourself on TV and in the world is so powerful. Like for me, before Athens 2004, I was racing against non-disabled swimmers, you know, and I watched Athens 2004. I saw people like myself on TV and I was like, wow, there's something that I can do. I can go to a Paralympics. And that's where my dream started. So I hope that there's so many people, not just in the UK, but in the world, watching the Paralympics and seeing what they can achieve, but maybe not just become the next Paralympian or get into sport, but just know that they can do anything no matter what. And it's making sure that the world is inclusive for them, you know, whether it's making adaptions, whether it's the education, the awareness. It's just educating society that, yeah, there is so many people with a disability out there. And yes, there's so many people that you can see with a disability, but there's so many also invisible, hidden disabilities too.
Ellie, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you have a fantastic time with the Games. And Ellie will be part of the Channel 4 presenting team for the Paralympics, which will have coverage of the Games every day until Sunday the 8th of September.
3 minutes to nine. It was meant to be the trip of a lifetime. Around the world cruise for 3 years, taking the Maldives, the Seychelles, Madagascar. 3 months in Belfast were not on the original plan. But that is what's happened, because the ship in question is currently stranded on board from Florida with her cat, Captain Holly Hennessy. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Have you ever been to Belfast before, Holly?
Actually, I have. 5 years ago, I came to Ireland for my first time and had no plans. So I started asking around and everybody said, don't bother with Belfast. And I didn't listen. And Belfast was my favorite part of that trip.
Oh, well, that's the good news. But presumably you weren't planning 3 months in Belfast.
Absolutely not.
How long did you think you'd be there?
Well, I arrived May 28th, and the ship was supposed to depart May 30th.
2 days. Uh-huh. And it's 3 months. So how are you spending your time?
Well, you know, I've become a local. There are about 200 of us who have been in and out of Belfast. I, because of Captain the Kitty, I've been stuck here. So Belfast has been home. I was in an apartment for 2 months, which meant I would visit your grocery stores and your butcher shops. And
it's good for business. But you and Captain have also been living on board as if on a cruise, but just not.
Well,
going
actually,
anywhere.
No, we're not allowed to stay aboard yet. We can spend the days there. Right. And the ship is functioning like a normal cruise ship. We have entertainment and movies and trivia, and the buffet is open and the crew is doing a magnificent job.
Holly, but I don't want to make you miserable, but where are you meant to be now?
I'd have to look at my calendar. But when we left, we were doing Northern Europe, the fjords, Iceland, Greenland, over to Canada. Now, because of the delay, it's going to be a southern itinerary. Right. And we're going to cross over to the Azores and Bermuda and then go to the Bahamas.
Bahamas or Belfast? Tricky choice?
Yes. Right.
You seem very good-humoured about it. You're happy to wait, are you?
Well, it is something I have wanted to do forever.